Yes. So, okay, any questions from your discussions during lunch? What we're going to, just so you know, what we're going to do now is go into the various how you help, the weeks and months before, the days before, the hours before, at the time of the breath, after, blah, 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 the whole process. We've looked at the overview a little bit of why we have to think about impermanence and death. We've looked at, you know, the ideal way to live our lives. We haven't done that much, but we'll do more. We've looked at the actual process and roughly how it happens. And now we'll look at and we've touched upon what's necessary to help the person, but we're going to go into more detail about that. Okay? So on based on what we've talked so far, are there any questions? If not, that's just fine. Yes, sweetheart. Yes, darling.
I was wondering about the experience of a being who is attracted to a test tube, who's born through artificial insemination. You're speaking about the beings who are attracted to...
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? I know.
The parents.
Yes.
In sexual union.
I know, it's totally interesting.
The aversion.
Yes.
And
I know.
My child was born through artificial insemination.
There you go.
And he happens to have a very extremely happy disposition.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if some of that lack of attachment and that happiness.
I know, it's totally. For me, of course, because all the great yogis have to talk about this, and there's been no really formal discussion or no teachings that I've heard on this one, because the way we describe it is, of course, the old-fashioned way you have a baby, you hop into bed with somebody, you know. So this one is very interesting. So first of all, it's a really good point, because first of all, okay, the egg and the sperm are put into they're put into some kind of little dish, and when do they put that into the womb? When do they put that into the womb?
Within minutes.
So they join them together and then stick them in. Okay, well, what's interesting is this, you see. I asked one lama, Yangtze Rinpoche, in my Tripa college in Portland. I said, basically the question, first of all, this is the first point. When, it's a really good one, when does the consciousness join that egg and sperm? So clearly the Christians must assume it's a real person already and the soul must be there, because that's why they say it's like you can't chuck them down the toilet, you know. But it was very clear from Yangtze Rinpoche, he said that the condition that's necessary for the consciousness to go into the egg and sperm is the human womb. So the egg and sperm have to be put into the wherever they put it. That then, without that, the consciousness won't go there. So even though the egg and sperm will start multiplying, it's not a human being yet. It's just cells. It's not a human. So you can chuck all your empty ones out the toilet. You're not killing anybody. There's no consciousness there. They need the presence of the human womb. So that's first of all, interesting point. So obviously there's not the one of being in the bardo and you're seeing your mummy and daddy having sex and you run there. So I wonder what it is that drives them to that egg and sperm. But maybe, then when you put it into your body, there was no man around, was there? You didn't have to have sex, did you? Yeah, I mean, you'd really think that's a person, what a relaxed way to go. Oh, there's my new mum, hi, hop in, no drama, you know. I mean, it really is fascinating. It really is fascinating. So I don't know. But still, nevertheless, you'd have to say, because this whole human realm that we exist in, which is part of the bigger realm that Buddha would refer to as the desire realm, which is driven by attachment. Everything is based on attachment. So there still has to be that very powerfully, because attachment is what drives us. Unless, of course, you're a highly advanced being, it could be with your child, and they just kind of go where they want. They're not driven by attachment, they're beyond attachment. So that might be, anyway, your child incidentally has not much attachment, perhaps. It could be connected, or on the other hand, there could be something, you might have given birth to a great yogi. Well done, dear. You know, good on you. So it's hard to say, because there won't obviously be that one, this intense drive towards the egg and the sperm. But obviously, if the egg and the sperm are in, the consciousness will only go there once it's in your body. So that's a pretty intense connection, that they've got to be attracted to you. And so obviously the sperm belonged to somebody. So was it a stranger or a person you knew? A stranger. You bought it. in the catalogue. But they've got, you've still got to argue there's got to be some connection with that person, because they end up looking like them, possibly. You understand? And you even hear these nightmarish stories now about all these boys who sell their sperm because they're students, they want to make money, and now they've got all these children all over the world turning up looking like, you know, multi versions of him, and all wanting their daddy, you know. So I mean, it's a bit scary, think about it. They're going to find they've got hundreds of children, all looking like this. It's just one Swedish man, and all these kids are turning up looking blonde, blue-eyed boys looking like his daddy. I mean, that would be very scary to feel all these children. And then probably if you're rich, they want your money as well. That's kind of intense. So there has to still be a connection. It makes sense. You've got to have the body. You've got to be looking like that parent. So there's got to be some karmic connection. But it can't be the same as what they say in the text. It just can't be, because the scenario is different. It's very interesting, isn't it? But it's still got to be driven by attachment, because as long as you're an ordinary person, attachment's the energy that forces them to go there even. Do you understand? So it's kind of interesting, isn't it? So thank you.
Thank you.
But excuse me, this is an extra point here. I'm just wondering why people have to spend... go back, please. Go back to her. I'm curious to know why you have to go buy sperm. A friend of mine, this girl in Seattle years ago, decided she wanted a baby. She asked her gay friend to squirt some sperm into a bottle. She's a nurse. She got one of these syringes and squirted the sperm up, and she had a very nice daughter, and that's free. Why don't you all do it like that? I'm really curious now. I'm wondering why you have to go to a catalogue and spend a fortune. And you go to doctors and everything. I mean, she just squirted it up and she had a baby. I'm wondering why people don't do that. Unless it's a bit personal to discuss. I'm sorry, but it's a bit blunt, that's all.
I think it's more, what? For the service of having it done to you and having it...
What do you mean? I just told you, she didn't need service. She did it herself. What?
The other people.
Which other people? But maybe if there's difficulty getting conceived, that's another discussion. But she just said, can you give me some sperm? And now also he happens to like the girl, and they have a very nice... So it's, you know, the girl, the child likes the daddy. It just worked out easily, that's all. It was cheap. It was all free. Free, you know. Anyway, I was just curious. Excuse me.
Can I confirm something that you just said? Yes. Just want to be sure I'm clear on it.
No, you look like you're cheering. Why?
Because this is important, whether or not the consciousness enters the moment the sperm and egg touch, or when that combined mass implants itself in the womb.
That's the second, like I said. Yeah.
That means that birth control is not killing.
Of course it's not.
Okay, because like the Catholic Church...
But why do you think it was?
Because the Catholic Church teaches the other way.
No, it's not because it's killing. Abortion is killing. But if the only purpose of sex is to have a baby. So birth control is against that. That's not killing, though, for the Catholics.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I was told it is in some religions, because they count from the time the sperm meets the egg.
No, that's another discussion again.
Okay.
Great. Okay, birth control means the egg and sperm never meet.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that can't be killing, can it? So the reason it's wrong if you're a Catholic is because God said that sex is only to have babies. That's why that one's wrong. The other one, yes, indeed, the egg and the sperm, they're assuming, the Christians are assuming as soon as the egg and sperm come together, even in the Petri dish, the soul goes there. That's why they say you shouldn't put them down the toilet. No, but that, I'm saying, from the Buddhist point of view, it's just an egg and sperm. It's not a person yet. It's got to have the entry of consciousness, and that'll only happen in the womb.
Thank you very much. I felt awful taking birth control and hearing that and thinking,
of course it's not killing.
I thought I was killing.
Of course it's not killing. I don't know. There's no person there. You're just having fun, that's all, and don't want babies. So any other questions? Any other questions? No. Okay, let's carry on then. No time to wait. Yes.
Yay.
Yep. Oh, darling? Yes.
I'd like to have a little clarification.
Be closer to the mic.
I'd like...
Yeah, like I always think, treat it like an ice cream. You're about to lick it.
A little clarification on those wisdoms, you know, like the wisdom of equality.
All those pieces, yeah.
And especially the second wisdom, which I never can get.
Which one? Let's have a look. I forget. Let's have a look. You can't distinguish between pleasure, pain, and indifference. Normally in our daily life, would you agree, we either want we have happy feelings, unhappy feelings, and indifferent feelings. Would you agree there's three categories?
Yeah, I understand that.
Well, that's what it is. You can't distinguish between the feelings of pleasure, pain, and indifference. Well, what's the wisdom? Let's go back. That's what it says, I think, the wisdom of something.
Equanimity.
Equanimity, yeah. So I think what they're saying, okay, the second one, vision of mirage. The aggregate of feeling is the first one. Okay, the wisdom of equanimity, which says, I don't understand this one either. It says the wisdom of equanimity, which sees pleasure, pain, and all that would be right. The wisdom of equanimity is the ability, having practiced, to not distinguish between pleasure, pain, and indifference. You've got equanimity towards that. That's what it is. Equanimity of your feelings.
Oh, sorry. Can you just say that again? I'm a little hard of hearing, I guess.
Okay. The wisdom of equanimity seems to be referring to the capacity of the mind to not distinguish between pleasure, pain, and indifference. If we're completely driven by attachment, we're junkies for the good feelings, right? And we can't stand the bad feelings. And also we forget the indifferent feelings. So if you've got this wisdom of equanimity, it seems, there's a balance there. Are you seeing my point? Is this about right? Sounds about right? Sounds about right? You're clear? Clear?
Not to distinguish.
Yeah, when you, I think it seems like you've practiced. Right now, if we're following attachment, we're up and down like yo-yos. Would you agree? Would you agree if you've got attachment, you're up and down like a yo-yo? You're craving all the good feelings.
Yes,
and when
you
don't have the good feelings, you're really upset and miserable. Would you agree? So there's no equanimity there, is there? But if you've begun to practice and you've got this wisdom of equanimity, your mind is more steady, more balanced. That's what I'm trying to say. Do you see? Does that make sense?
I see. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, darling. So you mean even my shouting doesn't make you hear better? He can't hear me. My God, I mean, I don't know if you can hear soft people talking. Never mind. Yes.
Rubina, I want to know if the consciousness gets out of the body through the chakra, the heart chakra, does it mean it's a human rebirth?
What?
Because we talked about consciousness getting leaving the body.
No, that's two things. One is the consciousness leaves the body through a particular place, but this is once the consciousness leaves the heart chakra, the second it leaves the heart chakra, it's going to leave through the eyes if you're going to be a human. It'll leave through the anus if you're going to be an animal. It'll leave through the mouth if you're going to be a spirit, like that. But the moment it leaves the heart chakra, is the point. It's got to leave from there and then it disappears, then it leaves in different places.
Okay.
Do you see?
Yes.
But it won't leave from the heart chakra.
Okay.
Not.
Okay.
No. You understand?
Yes.
Okay. Anybody else? Yes, darling, behind you.
I was wondering about conditions like dementia, Alzheimer's versus ALS. What happens when the
What's ALS?
It's Lou Gehrig's disease, where the mind is, you know, stays firm, but the body is slowly deteriorating.
So I can't understand you. Please say it more clearly for me.
Sure. So what happens when the mind and the body are essentially dying at different times?
What do you mean by that?
Like in Alzheimer's, your mind is slowly leaving you. Your consciousness seems to be slowly leaving you.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, no. I see what your point. Okay, no, the better way to put it is... Keep the mic. The better way to say it is this, from the Buddhist point of view. Okay, to understand this a bit better, we have to understand a little bit the Buddhist model of the mind. So in the West, we talk about the brain, right, don't we? Well, there's not the discussion here. There's zero discussion about a brain. You ask a great meditator in Tibet or somewhere where his brain is, he's never heard of the word a brain. So what they're talking about is the actual cognitive process. And it's all, at the grosser level, it's our thoughts. And there's trillions of thoughts. And those thoughts, trillions of them, are divided, this is the grosser level, are divided into three categories. Like I said before, you've got all the neurotic ones, all the voices of ego, I like to call them. Attachment, anger, pride, jealousy, low self-esteem, all the dramas. We all know those, right? They're the neuroses. They're all underpinned by this root delusion that is known as ego grasping, which is this primordial belief in a separate little me floating around there somewhere that runs the show. Do you understand? They're all the dramas. They're the cause of so much pain and suffering and fear and all the rest. They're the horrible ones, right? Then you've got the virtuous states of mind. Love and empathy and compassion and kindness and generosity and forgiveness. We know those as well. But the third set, and this is the ones that are beginning to leave in the people who've got senility or Alzheimer's. The ones who are gradually losing the plot. You with me? There's these several, many of these states in mind. I like to call them the mechanics of the mind. These are the ones that make you function properly, whether you're a bad person or a good person. So one of those, for example, is the ability to remember what you're doing from moment to moment. They call it mindfulness. We call it good memory. Do you understand? So as we start to get older, I mean, right now, I was a little girl and my grandma would forget names. And I'd say, oh, I'll never. She said, you wait, you'll forget names. I said, no, I won't. And sure enough, I can't to believe it. My friends in Boston, I leapt out of bed at 4 a.m. to help my friend go to the airport. And I was about to shout his name up the stairs and I couldn't remember his name. I had to go to my contacts on my email to find out my friend's name. I mean, I thought, am I getting Alzheimer's or what? So I forget names, not just movies, but friends. It really does happen. That's called, I mean, I don't know what kind of memory that is, but it's one of the mechanical parts of our mind that enables you to remember things. The one that's called mindfulness is in particular remembering what you're doing from moment to moment. You understand? So, you know, that's a really fundamental one. So whether you're a murderer or a meditator, you've got to have that one. Do you see? So these are neutral insofar as they're not virtuous and not non-virtuous. Then you've got, for example, a crucial one that's happening every millisecond. In the model of the mind in Buddhism, when you study all the components of the mind, there's these different groupings of these states of mind, the 20 secondary, the 6 this, the 4 that, and there's one group called the 5 always present states of mind, as we would call them. And one of those is called, for example, intention, which is really the meaning of the word karma. That's every millisecond. It's like volition. Every second that starts with I will walk out the door. I will eat my breakfast. I will scratch my nose. I will fart. Whatever. It starts with that, even though we don't think so. I mean, some things don't happen without the intention. True, the other one, the last one. Okay. Get my point. The scratching the nose, though, you wouldn't scratch your nose if there was not intention there. You couldn't. But it's so fast, we don't think it's really like intention, so automatic. Then you have intention, then you pay attention. There's one called attention. But then there's a crucial one I mentioned before called either recognition or recollection or another word, I can't think.
Discrimination.
Discrimination. And what it is every millisecond, it's functioning a trillion times a second. The fact that you can see there's orange, there's red, there's round, there's square, there's this. A million things in this room, we can already go boom, 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 boom. That's recognition. So when you start to lose that, and you look at the cup, what's that for? That one's disappearing. So all the pieces, these mechanical pieces, or these, if you like, that is concepts, slowly stop functioning. And that's what Alzheimer's, that's what senility is. That's not death. Your mind's not leaving the body. Just bits of your mind, conceptually speaking, are ceasing to function. Do you understand? So when your mind starts to leave the body, that's a very vivid difference. That's what death is. We're sort of heading towards death, if you like, but we all know a senile person can live for 30 years. A person with lousy memory can live for a long time. The actual death process is this very powerful process that begins at a certain point. It's like when you begin to go to sleep. It's this deconstruction of the pieces. You understand? Does that make sense? What's ALS?
It's a condition where your muscles essentially stop functioning slowly over time.
Well, that's physical, not mental. Your mind could still be perfect, couldn't it?
Right, exactly.
So even a person who looks like they're crazy and can't speak properly, their mind could be perfect. It's just that you can't express it with your physical. That's different. Do you see? Yeah. What else?
Thank you.
What else? Yes, here we go. Yes, sweetheart.
We talked about inadvertently ending somebody's life before it might be time to, in terms of harvesting organs. But how about the opposite, which is an increasing problem with technology?
That's right.
How do you know when to...
That's right.
Is it a bad thing to prolong?
Very difficult. And this is the trouble. We've created this dilemma for ourselves that because we're not clairvoyant, because we don't know the karma of this person, and because we're kind of in the West, we've got this very kind wish to keep people alive as long as possible, all our brilliance has kept people who are dead alive. I mean, or who would be normally naturally dying, isn't it? It's really a dilemma. It's really a dilemma. And that means you've got to decide when to pull the plug. It's not easy, is it? Even keeping people a bit healthy by breathing better, you got to know when to stop it. So it's just not easy. But, I mean, you know, I've heard His Holiness the Dalai Lama say, and other lamas would advise, for example, It's common sense that if you know the person isn't viable on their own without all the machines, then you know at some point you should. And it's like, in other words, instead of spending all those thousands of dollars every single day, far better for the karma of the person if you've got to really work it out, really be clear. And my feeling would be, it doesn't say this in any of the teachings, that if you do decide to pull the plug at some point, you've got to really be wise. And then secondly, if I were a Buddhist, I'd immediately consult my lamas and have special prayers done and ask them when it would be most auspicious to do it, you know, because you really know they can have them helping the person. That would be just a reasonable thing to do. But I've heard all of them say it's reasonable to do that, you know. So there's no thought to kill a person, but you've got to just take some of the life-supporting stuff off, you know, of course. And many people make that decision. Don't keep me on the thing. Like my friend Paul, when he got his wife and daughter to promise they wouldn't do that, she did it, and then they had to make the decision to stop the machine, you know. It's not that easy. It's not that easy. But I would say if you're a Buddhist, I would immediately consult my lamas and have special pujas and prayers done right then and work out when is the best time so you can have real support for that consciousness when it begins to go through the death process. Do you understand?
Yes. Yeah? Thank you.
But it's very interesting, also another interesting about exactly when is a person conscious and when is not. I don't know if you remember reading in the papers a few years ago, there's this one Italian mummy who kept her boy alive, insisted for like 25 years he was like a vegetable. He was kept alive for 25 years. He came back to consciousness and said he was conscious the whole 25 years.
Wow.
That would mean, using this model, his earth element didn't come back, but he was conscious. It was like he had lucid dreaming for 30 years, you know, 25 years. But he died soon after. But he came back and he said he was completely conscious the whole time. That's intense, isn't it? Now that proves, too, this is a very interesting point. You know, there's our old grandma, and she looks like she's in a coma. We're around the deathbed, all gossiping around and talking about her and her will and her money and what a creep she was or something. But she can be completely conscious hearing it all. So it's really heavy duty, you know, to be really aware. At the same time, I remember, this is a nice story, I like this story. One friend of mine in Sydney had gone into a deep coma, and she was in the ICU in one of the big hospitals, and they said that she wouldn't be coming back, whatever. So anyway, she wasn't really a Buddhist, but she knew many of the lamas. They'd lived in her house for years, that kind of thing, you know. So the husband, it was kind of funny too, because the husband was a judge, and he rang the hospital and said, can I come? He said that I'm her pastor or something, or her, you know, her whatever, pastor. And I wanted to come at night because you could drive quickly at night. There's no traffic, you know. Anyway, I'd be there about midnight. It's safe about an hour. And anyway, when I first arrived, they heard I was a Buddhist nun. And they said to me nervously, please don't play any bells, you know. I promised I wouldn't play any bells. So anyway, I would just stand there by her bed because the bed was very tall, all this stuff inside her. And I'd just say prayers loudly in her ear. But also, I remember when I first was there, and I knew immediately she was conscious in some way because she suddenly started to salivate and her head moved, you know? So anyway, the point was, every now and again, I'd say in her ear loudly, whisper loudly, Judy, Tsongsa Khyentse Rinpoche is praying for you. Judy, His Holiness Sakya Trinzen is praying for you. And then I'd shoot kings of prayers and those things. Then I'd leave. But anyway, she did come out of the coma, all perky and bright and back to normal. But she said, and it was 2 weeks, I think, the only thing she remembered was this husky voice. She said she thought it was a blue lady coming through the window saying, Judy, Tsongsa Khyentse Rinpoche is praying for you. Judy, His Holiness Sakya Trinzen is praying for you. The only thing she could remember. So that's interesting. All I can say is it's interesting. Do you understand? So there she's in a coma. But look what goes in, you know, and this is maybe if we have confidence in the Buddhas and all this business, you really can be beneficial when you think you can't be, you know. There's ways of helping, including a little doggy and pussy and the ant and everything else, when they look like they're unconscious, you know. So treat with as much respect when they're quiet, in a coma, as you would if they were wide awake, and keep having the prayers on, keep doing the different practices, which we're going to talk about. Because we just can't see, you know, we don't know. Okay, any more questions? Yes.
Just to clarify.
Yes.
Thank you. The source in Buddhist teaching, the source of cognitive processes is mind, not the brain, right?
Yes. That is the Buddhist view, which is not immediately evident to us. And even if we're, and especially if we've been trained in understanding the brain and neuroscience, this really does take some thinking to put these two things together, because it doesn't follow there's any contradiction. That's why these amazing talks over the last 30, 40 years between the Dalai Lama and all the best brains in the West, And there's the website of the organization, they're called Mind and Life. And they've organized many of these wonderful discussions. And much of it has been published from the best neuroscientists, from psychologists, from scientists. And there's incredible work that's now happening as a result of these discussions. You know, even on the whole thing about death. Because, yes, the Buddhist one, and this is coming from the Hindus, it's really fascinating history, you know. These Hindus, more than 3,000 years ago, there was this extraordinary kind of culture. And, of course, in our culture, you know, being Anglo, whatever it is, Catholic, Christian, Judaic, we track back to the, you know, to all the Romans and the Greeks. That's our history. We don't think about the Asians, the Indians, or the Chinese. But these Indians are absolutely remarkable beings, you know. And Buddha came out of this extraordinary tradition. So these Indians, these great thinkers, you know, they were the ones, as the Dalai Lama said, I saw this kind of when reading a book, that it was more, they was they more than 3,000 years ago who were the ones who came up with this, who began this astonishingly sophisticated, these are my words, astonishingly sophisticated investigation into the nature of self. And they're not talking about the brain now. And this is the big distinction between the Buddhist view, which came out of the Hindu one, about what the consciousness is. So this, for example, there's a type of meditation, which is a brilliant, sophisticated psychological skill that enables a person, these Hindus invented it, this enables a person with incredible discipline, and it takes a while to accomplish it, to access, to go beyond the gross level of conceptuality and actually access these far more subtle levels of their own cognitive process. Well, as we're discussing here using the Vajrayana model, we talk about gross, subtle, very subtle. Do you understand? So the gross is when indeed you will see the evidence of the brain if you are a brain person. But the Buddhist view and these Hindu view the same, that you're talking about not the brain, which is like an indicator of what's happening, but you're talking about the actual cognitive process itself, the actual thousands of conceptual thoughts. So you could argue even at this grosser level, Buddha's like a brilliant cognitive therapist. You understand? Brilliant cognitive behavioral therapist. I mean, at a really sophisticated level. Because, and I'll say more of this about in a minute. But as you learn this technique, you're learning to eventually, first to stabilize and then eventually cease altogether the gross conceptuality. And that's where if you did see a person who has accomplished what they call single-pointed concentration, they would look like they were dead. But they're totally conscious, but at a subtler level. And of course, we don't posit that level in our culture. It's just called mysterious, you know. But it is a subtler level of cognition, quite literally. And this is where now, talking about this one, in terms of daily Buddhist practice, Lama Yeshe, our teacher, often would say, being a Buddhist is being your own therapist. And what this means is this. Taking the view that I've got these millions of thoughts in my mind, I like to call them my roommates. I mean, there's countless numbers of them. We all know that. And they're called, first of all, the negative ones are called anger and jealousy and depression and low self-esteem. We all know them. Then you've got the ones that are called love and kindness and these ones. And then you have all the mechanical ones that make it all work well. Concentration, attention, intention, recognition, memory, all this stuff, right? All working away. And what they're referring to is not that piece of the brain, but the actual concept, the actual thought. And it's highly sophisticated. And so when you get more concentration and you've become your own therapist, you've got this astonishing capacity to unpack and unravel all these millions of thoughts that we just call unconscious at a subtler level. And you can really see each thought and hear each of the voices crystal clear and see your mind at the most astonishing level of subtlety. Are you understanding what I'm saying? And it's a purely cognitive process. And you don't have to know anything about your brain to do it. But it takes immense effort. But this is what these Hindus came up with. And then Buddha came out of that tradition. And as a basis of all the work these Hindus did, they came to some very incredible conclusions in their own mind about exactly what is the self. So Buddha diverged from there because he came to what he would suggest is even subtler understanding about actually what the self is. And all the Buddhist teachings lead to that one. So the whole process, so then you know, like in our culture, if let's say you're a therapist and I've got problems, I keep attracting lousy boyfriends, you know, I'm coming to you, and depending on what method you use, but in general we would agree, wouldn't we, in the West, your assumption is my mother and father made me, your assumption is My mind is my brain. I'm a product of the genes, the DNA, all the chemicals and all the drama. But also, crucially, I'm a product of what people have done to me throughout my life. So naturally, you will look into the past, you look into my chemicals, you look into the events, sort of like looking for, and we all feel this, looking for a needle in a haystack, which is the cause of how come Rabina started getting angry and choosing lousy boyfriends and getting jealous and depressed, or whatever. And I'm not trying to be sort of superficial here. But the Buddha's view says you can do that, no problem. It's very good to look at the past, because that's the conditions. But the crucial point for the Buddha, they're merely the catalysts. They're merely the catalysts, including even the physical, for the actual cognitive event called anger. So the Buddha's view is, Rabina, you get angry, darling, do you? That's very interesting. You choose lousy boyfriends. I totally agree with you because you're an idiot. But let's see what we can do about your own. Let's see how you can look into your own mind. So I've got to learn to get some concentration. Learn to even begin to have the courage to even admit I've got thoughts and feelings and emotions. And guess what? Buddha says, the anger is mine. The boyfriend punched me, no argument. My father abused me, no argument. But the anger, the jealousy, the low self-esteem, they are my own cognitive process. And that on the basis of having these, then these lousy events then triggered those and increased my misery, increased my anger. But of course, we know anger says you did it, so I'm going to keep focusing on the object. But Buddha says I've got to look into the actual cognitive process called anger itself, and then to unpack and unravel its story, because it's a very highly sophisticated, ridiculous, conceptual drama. And I can only see that once I calm the emotional component down and go deeper into my own mind, then I can really be my own therapist, really unpack and unravel my own angry thoughts, my own assumptions, because there are all these elaborate conceptual assumptions. And that one's based on attachment, which is based on this, which is based on that. There's this kind of hierarchy of these conceptual thoughts. So it's quite a sophisticated job to do, but very intense job to do, but it's totally personal. Do you see what I'm saying?
Thank you.
It's a long answer, but does that make sense, people? So it's a very fundamentally different approach in this sense. And we really understand this, and we're on track with understanding Buddha's approach, you know. Because until then, even as Buddhists, we're all addicted to what people did to us. Well, it's his fault. You know, we blame people for making us suffer, but we blame people for making us happy as well. Oh, why are you happy, Rabina? Well, I had a good meal. Don't blame the food. You have a capacity for happiness. Look at that one. You know, John punches me in the nose. Yeah, he punched me, no problem. But that's not your problem. My problem is my anger. And this is really tricky one, this. Very, very subtle. But needs a lot of courage to do it. Then you really can own your own mind, you know, and have power over it. This is the point. So anyway, let's carry on here about the what to do when. Okay. So the way Rinpoche goes through the actual, all the different things to do, it starts roughly with what to do during all the weeks and the months and weeks before death. It's kind of practices to do during the months and weeks before death. Your book would be chapter 3, start of chapter 3. So first of all, as I mentioned briefly, Rinpoche talks about how helping others at the time, that's a big responsibility. Then he talks about helpers should be close to the dying person. Rinpoche says, or Chön Rinpoche, his lama, says that people who help, who give advice and support, you know, and especially the one who speaks the name of the person's guru in their ear when their breath stops. There's a particular practice they all talk about, which sounds very hilarious to us, when we'll get to that in a minute, when the breath stops. And you say the name very loudly of their teacher, whatever. We'll discuss that later. Never mind that now. Shouldn't be someone they dislike. Obviously. Even when you're slightly sick, to have a person around you can't stand will just make you more distressed, you know? Isn't it? Awful. So there should be a pure spiritual relationship with the person. Got to really be close friends. And then, of course, he says, in order to ensure that attachment doesn't arise in your loved one's mind, even, especially when the time of death is close, Rinpoche advises that it's best not to allow anyone for whom they have strong attachment to be in their presence. Ideally, you shouldn't even mention their name. I mean, this is very difficult for us because in our culture, we don't distinguish between attachment and close. You know? So we really got to have a sense of what this means. So trying to be punitive and mean to our poor dying friend. No, you're not allowed to see your sister. You're too attached to her. No, not like that. It's unkind. Is it because the point is, all the way through this, the intense function of attachment arising in the dying and dead dying person is so intense that having an object or a person or their pussycat or their dog or their things or their music that they are attached to, meaning clinging to, meaning frantic and fearful of losing, this is too unbearable for their mind because they eventually have to let it go. And it's beyond bearing to do this. So it creates such intense fear in the person's mind, you know. So that means you have to have some sense of even what attachment is. Otherwise it's just confusing hearing these words. Of course, if that person can help your loved one, so they're very, it's not that they really love you and attached to you, but you know what you're doing, then you can be in control of it and it'll be helpful to them. You'll be helpful to them. That's different, you know. Of course, as Rinpoche says, I mentioned at the beginning, your ability to help your loved one depends on what you have practiced throughout your own life. It goes without saying, you know. The more you understand what you're supposed to do for your own death, the more you'll know how to help your loved one. The less you know, the less wisdom you will have. It's sort of obvious. The less ready you are, the more you'll panic and won't know what to do. When you know how to die with a peaceful mind, then you can confidently help your loved one. You'll be able to create the right conditions so that it's easy for their minds to be transformed into virtue. And keep hearing, virtue means peaceful. Virtue means open, expansive, loving, compassionate, relaxed. Don't hear it as religious. Virtue meaning peaceful. They come together, you know. Loving, compassionate, open, spacious. That's virtuous. And that means peaceful. You need to be skillful in advising your loved one according to their state of mind, their background, their life. Whether they're a non-believer or have a religion or a Christian or Muslim or whatever, you need to know them, you know how to help them. I mean, if they're a communist and you start talking about Jesus, I tell you, go away, you know. But if they're a Buddha, they're a Christian, and you start talking about some green lady called Tara, they'll freak out. So you have got to have some common sense, you know. So this is one of the questions back here, which we'll talk about. Yeah. Okay. So, create a conducive environment for a peaceful death. So the idea, so most of us, you know, okay. What this means is if the more you understand this, the more you'll have real control over the whole scenario. And this is why if a person dies in hospital, which I suppose is common, isn't it? Is most people who had dying people, have they been in hospital? Or been, how many of you have had dying people at home? Oh, quite a few. Well, that's encouraging. They stayed at home when they died. Okay. Could you have left them for 3 days if you'd known about that? Some of you? You did. There you go. That's interesting, isn't it? And I had a friend. Who was it here? Somebody. Who was it? Where are you? Who did that research for me? You. Yeah. You did that research, remember, about the states. And there's very easygoing laws in some states about what you can and can't do, isn't it? Didn't you discover that?
Right. Unless
there was some... Give me the mic. This is very interesting. Go on. Tell us the research you did for me. I didn't use it much in the book because Lama Zobi didn't talk about it, but it is helpful. Go on.
The best that I could understand from all the research about the conditions of death in all, at least all the first world countries, is that if there's any suspicion or unexpected death,
yeah,
like if a healthy infant suddenly dies, or someone who appears healthy suddenly dies, then you have to report it and a doctor has to confirm that there's nothing suspicious about, you know, nothing out of sorts with the death within 24 hours.
Otherwise,
if somebody was expected to be dying, if there's nothing unusual about the fact that the person might have died then, although the death needs to be confirmed by a doctor or somebody who's qualified to within 24 hours, you don't have to move the body.
Okay,
but
I see.
If it's suspicious, then there needs to be an investigation within 24 hours.
Right. So in other words, you've got to have somebody within 24 hours of they're stopping breathing, you're saying.
Yes.
Well, see, even that's a big window, isn't it? 24 whole hours where you have somebody come in and announce that they're pronounce that they're dead, but you get up to and then you're allowed to leave the body there for as long as you like. That's interesting, isn't it? Because often many people are just scared to do it. But it's like, again, you've got to know the rules and the laws of what you're allowed to do. It's really important. And even you could bury them in the backyard in some states, couldn't you? Didn't you see that?
There's public health rules mostly prevent that.
Okay. Which rules?
Public health.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Public health, okay. Okay, well, I know when Lama Yeshe passed away in 1984, it was in California. He passed away in Los Angeles in a hospital. Well, they were allowed to take him. It was very interesting. They were given the body, you know. Whereas when I went to my friend's death in Santa Cruz Hospital, they wouldn't let us take the body. We had to go to the mortuary. Whereas with Lama Yeshe, one of the students, he was allowed to stay all day in a bed, meditating, as Lama's put. Then they took the body and they put him in the back of, you know, one of the trucks. And then Tom drove him really slowly, you know, 8 hours. Normally it took probably 20 hours, driving really slowly and carefully all the way along, all the way from Los Angeles to near Santa Cruz, Boulder Creek. And then we kept the body for a week at Vajrapani Institute. And all the people came from all over the world. We then had all these pujas and prayers. And because he was meditating the whole time, after like 6 days at least from the time he stopped breathing, his body was still flexible and it didn't stink, you know, because his subtle mind was still there, even though he was driven and everything, which is what happens with these meditators, you know. But then we were allowed to take him home and have our own funeral, which we did at the center, you know, basically a fire puja, which we'll talk about later. That was really helpful. So make the place, okay, be in charge of the process. So make the place beautiful. It's sort of reasonable, you know. Make it look like a sick room. Don't make it, Lama Zobi doesn't say this, but I know what he means. Don't make it all cluttered and full of rubbish and things and bottles everywhere. You've got to make it totally beautiful. And it's really logical reason. The person's going to be in that room every day. This is the weeks and months before. They're not dead yet, you know. They're going to be stuck there. Maybe they'll get out a little bit. Depends on the person. So whatever, you see, the thing is, we've got these senses, right? So if you see things that are messy and dirty and broken and dark, what do you think it's going to do to your mind? What do you think it's going to do? You know, it's incredible. But if it's beautiful, clear, with the lovely views out the window, the sun, the light nice and clear, and if they're a Buddhist, let's say, images, wherever you look, you see your guru, you see the Buddhas you're close to. Like one of my friends is sick and is dying very slowly. She's got things on the ceiling, you know. Everything, in other words, and this is reinforced by this view about karma, that whatever we see, whatever we hear, these two especially, I'd say, whatever we taste, touch, smell, but these two especially, scenes, leave an impression, a seed in the mind. So surely, when I'm dying, I want to be programmed every minute of the day, please, with the pictures of my gurus, with the sound of my gurus' voices, with the things related to them, because I very definitely want to continue along, get another birth, so I can carry on being a Buddhist. That's my wish. It's up to you to decide, you know. So I want to see and hear things that will encourage that. It's clear. And I want, you know, the room should be beautiful for this person. You should, you know, have whatever they like in there, flowers. And if you're a Buddhist, you would have beautiful things like stupas and prayer wheels and statues and tankas, but things that would please your mind, please you. When you look, it makes you pleased and peaceful. I remember one time the Lama said this when you do a retreat. We tend to get a bit fundamentalist and think we're supposed to be all renounced, you know. But I remember one time I did a 3 month retreat when I got sick. That time I got very sick. I went home to Australia. And I did a 3 month retreat. Well, I mean, I was where my family lived. It was in Melbourne. It was at our centre there, which is in this big old Victorian house in a very kind of rich suburb. It was very beautiful, with lots of very peaceful old place. And I made the room beautiful with tankas. And so when I woke up in the morning and when I went to bed at night, I spent 99% of my time of that 3 months in that room, and it made me happy to be there. So clearly, if you're happy, you want to do your practice. If it's miserable and cold, don't try to be like Milarepa. It's too advanced. Make yourself comfortable. Make it beautiful for the person. It lifts their heart, you know. It's so logical. Display the things. Now, the position of the bed, there's a particular thing in Buddhism. You know, you've seen that statue of the Buddha? This one? On the picture of your booklet. That's called, he died like that, apparently. And so people often talk about replicating that when you die. And you practice this when you go to sleep. You have your legs out, you have your hand along here. And you're even supposed to have your finger up this nose, you know, which is a bit ridiculous, like that. Because that's, they say, the attachment energy, so you're blocking it when like this, but if you can stuck a bit of cotton up there, it'll do. But I try to sleep this way, and it's too uncomfortable, you know. Then my left nostril blocks, and I don't breathe, you know, so it doesn't work. Anyway, and then they all talk about having the head facing the north, which means your face will face the west. And this reason is because, you know, now we're going to talk about another whole discussion, which I'll talk about today or tomorrow. I've got tomorrow too, haven't I? Oh, I can calm down. Thank you. About another type of... There's two types of rebirth that as a Buddhist you should aspire to have. One is called Amitabha's Pure Land and one is called a human birth. So I'll discuss Amitabha's Pure Land later. I had no interest in this until I did this book. Now I'm a fan, I promise. I'll explain it. Meanwhile, though, they say that Amitabha is from the Western world, so you're facing the West. All this is for very devoted Buddhists, okay? It's meaningless if you're a communist or your mummy's a Christian. But you could do it if you want to, you know? No tobacco. This is interesting. All the Buddhists, the Tibetans especially, in the Vajrayana, they talk about tobacco being this very, at a subtle level, a really destructive herb. And we all know it is. At the gross level, it causes cancer. So the way they talk about it is quite destructive. At a subtle level, and it messes up your subtle nervous system and your subtle mind. It really destroys. And they also say it can attract very harmful types of beings. We don't think this way in the West, but this is what they say. So keep out of the way of tobacco. No smoke anywhere near where this dying person is. Rinpoche quotes Panchen Lama Chökyi Gelsen, one older Lama from long ago. When he was asked to do a particular practice called Powa, and we're going to talk about this, it's called transference of consciousness. It's a very advanced practice from the Vajrayana that individuals themselves can do, or once you've stopped breathing, a Lama can do on your behalf, that enables the consciousness to leave through the crown chakra. And if it leaves through the crown chakra, it will be born in a pure land. So we'll discuss all this later, okay? But this Panchen Lama, he would always, if people asked him to do this practice, the first thing he asked was, do they smoke? And if they did, he said he couldn't do the practice, because this seems to be at a subtle level, messes up all your chakras and your channels and everything, you know? That's what they say. No pets. This is shocking for us. And again, remember the reason. You want the person to be not attached, not grasping, not clinging, not fearful, because that'll trigger a negative karmic seed, which will throw them into a suffering rebirth. So it's got logic to it here in this model, in this system. It's not meant to be kind of punitive. You're not allowed to like your cat. Because we have so much attachment to our animals, you know. And you wouldn't even be at all surprised if you're really attached to your animal, that'll cause you to get an animal's rebirth. Because that's what attachment does. Attachment's so powerful. It runs so much of what we do in our minds, you know. This is a very particularly Buddhist view. So you've got to study it in more depth to really get your head around it. No animal skins as well. You know? Take the animal skin off their bed, which is very Tibetan, of course. They sleep on animal skins. We sleep on our nice, fine cotton sheets. So, a calm and peaceful environment. You must not create a situation that disturbs your loved one's mind. You make them angry or upset. Don't have anyone emotional in the room, especially when death is close. It's best that people don't cry within hearing distance of your loved one, as this creates clinging in their mind. It's so distressing. And you should not hold on to them. Crying and pleading with them not to die won't keep them alive. It will only agitate them and make their death more difficult, you know? In other words, you should create an environment that is calm and peaceful. This cannot be stressed enough. I remember reading about when Frank Sinatra died. I read his biography recently. I like Frank. I love his music. He sounded like a pretty negative person. Quite aggressive, quite arrogant. I mean, he sounded like, if it can be taken as you see it. So, you know, and I think enormous attachment. So there he was dying, finally. And his wife, apparently, is screaming at him. Frank, hold on, hold on. Frank, hold on. Like as if it's some virtue. Can you only imagine the torture? Because you know you can't, finally. This would be like beyond nightmare way to die. It's like you're falling off a cliff. It's beyond terror, isn't it? Beyond terror. Because you can't stop it. Finally, you can't cling. Finally, you can't hold on. Finally, you can't control things. And one of the multifacets of attachment is we're control freaks. Attachment is dissatisfaction. Attachment is craving. Attachment is manipulating and controlling. Attachment is possessing. Attachment is exaggerating the deliciousness of something. And attachment is looking forward to something. And all of this is a function of attachment. And this is the main delusion that runs our mind like a motor every second. And this is what grows stupendously at the time of death. Because finally, there's nothing to look forward to if you haven't thought about these things. There's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing you can do, finally. It would be beyond bearing. And that's why death is so much fear for most people. So within all that, all of this makes sense, you know. So now, Rinpoche, He recommends so many practices that it's completely overwhelming for most people, I promise you. So we have to really think about how to structure all this. So we divided up all the practices into what, first of all, what to see and touch. There's a whole bunch of things he recommends there. Then there's what to talk about. Then what to think about. What to meditate on. There's about, you know, probably 87 different things he advises. Which is overwhelming for most people. But he does it. It's his book, so he's allowed to have it. So it has to be structured nicely. No? So the first lot, and again, 99% of these you might not even want, and that's cool. You don't have to. So, you know, he's really big on, for example, this is seeing and touching, okay? So seeing makes sense, leaves an impression in the mind. So there you are, Buddhist, dying. Let's say a Buddhist. And what, you know, so naturally you want the Buddhist images, the pictures of your Lama, the things that will warm you, that give you courage, that give you enthusiasm, that give you comfort. So sensible. Obviously, if your mummy's a Christian, she really does love God, and she loves Jesus. Put a picture of Jesus really close. You got to know what the person wants. Some person I know is a Christian, but she doesn't talk about Jesus. She talks about God. So there's no images for God, you know. So it depends on the person. If they're a Hindu, you put Hindu images there for them. The ones they want, you know. You got to know the person, what they want, what they need. So things to touch is an interesting one. All the senses count for the Buddha. And Rinpoche is really a big fan of these things. So, you know, for example, there's different things to see. Okay, other things to see, sorry. He's really big into seeing certain mantras. And in the book, I think, in that book, there's certain mantras you can see and there's certain you can print out and have them there. He says just seeing them can be so beneficial for the person's mind. Show the names of Buddhas. Show the mantras. Now, things to touch. Touch the body with holy words, which is either texts or mantras. The Catholics do this. We used to have, what do you call them? Those things we packed up?
Scapula.
Scapula, right. Holy words in there. You know, Catholics do that. It's a similar idea, you know. But here particularly also mantras. So in the book there's a whole bunch of mantras on one of those pages you print out and you put them physically, words up, on the body. So if you think, what a load of rubbish, well then don't do it. You don't have to do it. It's his book though, because he'd have to say whatever he's got. I've got to report on what he says, you know. Do you understand? There's a particular text. I mean, Rinpoche is so funny what he does, you know. He's just so wonderful. There's a very powerful text that he's got that he likes a lot. And he's done miniature copies of it. He says technology's great these days. So he's got miniature copies of this little book. And he's got this little kit that you can buy from the FPMT website. It's called the Liberation Box. It's got a stupa in it, because it's one of the things to touch or to see, a stupa, which says to represent enlightened mind, right? There's a stupa in this box. There's we call them blessing strings, but it's called a blessed cord, using proper English. Here it is, a string, like dressmaker's stuff, that's blessed with mantras, you know? Mm-hmm. Just like the Catholics, I promise. You wear that. That's supposed to touch your skin.
Excuse me.
You've got a particular text that he had reduced, and it's in this little box. You've got some blessed strings, a couple of blessed pills. We'll talk about those later. There's a stupa, the text, there's mantras, and there's other things. A little kit, and you can buy that, you know? If you like all these ideas, you don't have to do them.
Venerable Rabina, sorry.
What?
One, a statement, and second, a question. The statement is for people who are members here. I just want people to know that there are two liberation kits in a cupboard here, so that if something happens to one of your loved ones or they're approaching death, there are the liberation boxes here at the center.
So you can borrow them.
What? That they can take them and have them.
Okay.
And it has a copy of the PDF.
Of what?
Of the How to Die, this one. You just finished editing.
No, it's not. It's a PDF. Huh?
The PDF that you did.
Oh, you put it in there?
Yes.
The whole book?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good, brilliant.
Okay. And then...
On a stick?
No, I put the whole book in there because if they're there and needing to be able to read...
450 pages?
Yes, I did.
Oh, that's the free version of this book?
Yes. Yes, it's in there.
I keep saying we shouldn't be taking away from Wisdom Sales, but never
okay,
mind.
But,
that's
well,
good.
This was before it came out, and I wanted it in there. So then the question is when I attended somebody in the last few months...
By the way, she's got a job here, but it's invisible because she hasn't been announced yet. What's your job?
Spiritual support.
For dying people and sick people.
And sick
well, she should have a proper label, like all... Anyway, Donna knows about that. We're going to make it public.
It'll
go
get
on.
More public.
So go on.
So here's a question. I was with someone who was dying recently, and we were doing prayers. And one of the things, I'm just going to say it. It was Tim. And when they...
That's right.
Taking Tim from the room, one of the things that I did was... that we had had mantras on his chest and medicine Buddha on his chest.
Yep.
And when he left the room, even though I knew that they would take them off and they might get thrown away.
Yeah, go on, question.
I left those on his chest.
Of course you should, much as you can,
Okay. And
I'll throw them out, they will. Then
they will, but I asked them if they could leave it on his chest as long as possible, and they said they would. So that's my question is, I know I'm never supposed to...
Yeah, honey, you take a risk, please, doesn't matter. She's worried about them tipping it in the bin, and not supposed to put holy words in the bin. Don't worry about it, you can't help it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, come on.
Then you answered my question.
So what happened to his body once all his organs got out? They sewed him up, and who did they give the body to?
The parents that went back to their parents.
You never saw the body after that?
I never saw the
parents. You never gave mantras for the parents to help bury him and everything? No, they were Christians, weren't they?
They were, Christians.
That's fine.
Good.
All right.
Thank you, darling.
Thank you. So, okay. And Roger's got in this box the one you can get from FPMT. It's a little miniature version of this little text that he likes. Just stick it on the person. Bless the body with a stupa. Just have the person touching the body sometimes, touching the crown, touching the body. Rinpoche's a big fan of all these things. Turn a prayer wheel. He's a big fan of those. Blessing cords. That's to touch and see. Now what to think about. Well, first of all, make sure your loved one's given away their possessions. That means writing a will. So the tradition, Tibetan one, of course, they wouldn't have a will, but they'd make sure at this time that they help the person give everything away. This is really powerful for the person's mind. It stops them grasping at it because it's no longer theirs. And also it's very powerful karma for the person to have generosity. You know, it's very good for them to make sure they give their stuff away. They have a nice saying in Tibetan. They said, your last speech is the will, your last food is the relics, and your last drink is the blessed pills. This comes later, okay? So talk about what to talk about. Well, talk, if they're a Buddhist, talk about your loved one's gurus. Talk about Lama Zopa. Talk about Lama Yeshe to me. Remind me of my lamas. Because your mind, you know, you're really scattered and you can't put two thoughts together when you get very sick, can you? You can't hold your thoughts. So that's why you need someone to just tell you these things. Hear them, you know? You listen, or you talk about Buddha, or you talk about God. This is your question now, the gentleman. What's your name? I forget. What's your name, darling? On the corner.
Lloyd.
This is now your question. If you've got your mummy who's a Christian, you talk about God. And this is my point now. Often our Christian parents, they've forgotten about God, you know? But they've got no place, no view in place of it. So you've got to really be brave, I think, to open the conversation, not be nervous about talking about things that might upset them. Even if they don't even know they're dying. And I mean, you don't say, oh, do you believe in God still, Mum? No. You'd self start talking about God. Well, you know, I was thinking about God recently, Mum, and it really made me very happy to think God is everywhere and God's taking care of me. She's going to hear that, and then she'll grab onto that. You'd be skillful, you know. If she says, oh, shut up about God, then you'd be quiet. You understand? You've got to really be brave, though. Talk about God. So then her mind will hold on to that, and it'll make her happy. Because remember, he says, talk about God, that God is love, God is wisdom, God loves you, God's looking after you. This is so consoling to think of somebody taking care of you. Please, it's so helpful, you know. So, so helpful. Of course, if you're a Buddhist, the Buddha, the Guru, these ones, huge, massive. You can talk about... you know, you can say to the person the nature of their mind, their heart is really pure, that God has compassion for everyone, including you, that God loves you, God is within, all these things. And then this can calm their guilt and their fears and their anger down. Especially if God loves you and loves you and is encompassing. It's like blissful words for a person. It's like nectar for their ears. It's so, so helpful. But that means you've got to know the person's mind. But be brave as well. And that means if they don't know they're dying, you don't have to force them to think about that. But you start talking about these things, it's so pleasant for them. Because there is so much fear there, and people can't express their fears. Because I think in all sentient beings, including animals, there's a very instinctive feeling that you know you're dying. You know, but people can't bear to acknowledge it. So you bring other ways to make them peaceful, to open their mind to it, so they can start daydreaming and even dreaming about God and heaven, you know. You talk about, so if you're a Buddhist, you talk about Amitabha's Pure Land, and I'm going to talk about this later. Or you talk about heaven. How heaven is beautiful. All your friends are there. It's divine. Everything's much better in heaven. I mean, there's nothing wrong with this, you know. It's just perfect. Why not? Make the mind peaceful. Use any tool you like to help the person be peaceful. And then this is the crucial point. Because there's so much attachment. And when it comes, they will have attachment for it. One of the things about attachment is this. Look at our minds. We always like to think about something. And if this is why we get depressed, if there's nothing nice to think about, nothing nice to look forward to, that's why you get depressed and unhappy. And if you've got angry thoughts and remembering your mean things you did and you feel guilty, or remember your ugly husband and how he was mean to you, then you get all freaked out about that. But start thinking of nice things. Start thinking of how lovely heaven is. Then your mind will lift and you start daydreaming about that. So you understand, it's just, it's practical. But again, all this means you've got to understand the mind. And that means you've got to understand your own mind. Clearly, for a Buddhist, you talk about their guru. Talk about, you know, the Buddha, their guru. Talk about, so the Pure Land is something really interesting now. Okay, let me talk about the Pure Land. 325. Okay. So to do this properly, we have to go back a bit and just, let's look at the whole Buddhist understanding of the mind and the way it functions and the whole universe in a sense. I've got to keep it brief, okay? So, okay, Buddha's saying, in the Mahayana Buddhist teachings, Buddha is saying that every one of us has the potential to fully develop this consciousness of ours, literally to perfection. A couple of years ago in Melbourne, I was participating in a conference at the Catholic University in Melbourne, and I was like this token Buddhist and gave a little talk. So I gave a talk called The Similarities Between God and Buddha. I looked up the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and the definition of God was three essential qualities: infinite wisdom or omniscience, infinite compassion, and infinite power. That precisely is the are the characteristics of what Buddhism refers to as a Buddha. So the similarities are this, meaning if you think of God, you think of something not physical, isn't it? If you think of Jesus, you think of a human body. But God is said to be all-knowing, all-compassionate. God is everywhere. As a little girl, as a Catholic, I love the idea of God being everywhere. I try to think and think about what it meant that God is everywhere. And I think God is in the margin of my schoolwork. You know, I try to imagine God is there. I couldn't get it, you know. Then God is in the light switch, I'd think. I didn't know how to think. I tried to think about what it meant that God is everywhere. Interestingly, I never thought of God as my creator. So I never had guilt. Catholics talk about guilt. I had no guilt. I thought it was stupid to be guilty, you know. Not this kind of guilt about God. I didn't mind, you know. So when I gave up God, when I was 19, decided I preferred to have boys and drugs and jazz. Goodbye, God. Hello, boys. Very simple decision. No drama, you know. Anyway, never mind. That was something else. Sorry. So, as a Catholic, I was in love with God. Loved God. And I love this. So this idea of God is everywhere. So that means non-physical energy, which of course, if you're a materialist, is just completely rubbish. But the Buddha says exactly the same. The difference is this, though, for the Buddha: all consciousnesses, all minds, in their nature, are actually not physical. So right now, here we are, our consciousness is, we're embodied, aren't we? We're a living being, and the living part of us is the presence of our consciousness. But consciousness is not physical. So what confines our consciousness to just this body, and again, what prevents us from seeing past our own noses, what prevents us from remembering more than a half a dozen things today, even accurately, is because we're overwhelmed by our deluded aspects of our consciousness, the narrowness of our ego and our attachment and our anger and our fears and our sensory and our massive attachment to this body as being me. So as we progress spiritually, and I was suggesting this before when I discussed clairvoyance, this is the Buddha's view, as we progress spiritually, lessening the neuroses, lessening the delusions, lessening, you know, and more growing our capacity for cognition, for wisdom, for compassion, for awareness, it's literally that you're expanding your consciousness, you're expanding your capacity for cognition that will gradually include the past, the future, the minds of others, and things in the distance. This is called clairvoyance. And for the Buddha, like I said, this is a completely natural function of minds. Not some hippy-trippy thing that some people kind of vaguely remember being an Egyptian princess 47 lives ago, you know. It's something clear and reasonable that we can all access. And the Buddha would say in countless lives, we've had this level of wisdom, but we've lost the plot, you know. So as we keep progressing and keep expanding our consciousness, keep lessening delusions and growing wisdom, you eventually achieve, you know, don't hold your breath, quite a few lifetimes to go probably, what they call Buddhahood. You become a Buddha. Well, the characteristics of a Buddha, like with this idea of God, this is the similarities, I'll now talk about the differences, are your consciousness is wherever there is existence. It's the capacity for cognition. It is not physical. So it can't be confined by space or time or matter, can it? Not possible. So your mind will be wherever there is existence. It will cognize that which exists without mistake. Second, it will be because ego is utterly gone, and ego and the presence of the neuroses are what separate us from others, and that causes to be this sense of a separate, lonely, bereft, poor, pathetic, self-pity little me. That's gone a million years ago. We are now as big as space and have infinite, effortless empathy with every single sentient being, virtually as if they were you. No longer a distinction, no longer any dualism, if you can conceive of this. And thirdly, this characteristic called power, this mind that has accomplished this, and this is the crucial point for the Buddha, these qualities are naturally, logically, the potential of every single mind. Whereas the Christian one obviously is one person like that. This is a big difference, I would say, obviously, one of them. Secondly, you know, the characteristic of God for Christianity is, for example, Christianity, is that he, whatever, is the creator, is the source of everything else. There's no concept like that in Buddhism. He says we don't need creating by somebody else. Buddha even uses the term superior being, and we become at a certain progression in our own spiritual practice. We become called a superior being, not in the way they call it in Christianity. And then you keep progressing until you've achieved Buddhahood. So then your consciousness pervades the universe. You see that which exists. You have infinite empathy. And the crucial one, the third one, you have this effortless and infinite power to do whatever needs to be done for as long as time exists to benefit sentient beings, including manifesting in many bodies throughout space as long as time exists. And the Buddha would simply say that is the natural potential of every single mind, every ant, every dog, every human, every Hitler, every pedophile, every racist, every Mr. Trump. Whether they can access it, that's another discussion. That never goes. And there's all the teachings that are dealt with in great depth, all of this stuff, you know. So the Buddha says the potential for Buddhahood is the natural potential of all beings. And because your mind is beginningless and endless, you don't need creating by an external force. Just not, Buddha says, an extra bell and whistle. You don't need it. So, okay, so when you fully develop Buddhahood, you know, if you become Buddha and I become Buddha and Tenor becomes Buddha, then you could argue there's only one Buddha. You could argue that. It's known as the Dharmakaya, the all-knowing, all-compassionate, all-wise, all-blissful, all-seeing consciousness. And trillions of beings have achieved, or millions have, thousands have, perhaps whatever. And so you don't sort of, then, you know, if you think of something non-physical, the all-knowing awareness and cognition, you can't imagine two of them. It's in a sense got to be the same. But there are millions. So now this is the point. Okay, let's say you achieve Buddhahood. And what's compelled you to achieve Buddhahood is your immense compassion. What allows you to achieve Buddhahood is your wisdom conjoined with that compassion. So then you don't just sit in the sky hanging out being blissful, you know. No. Because you've been driven by empathy and compassion for countless lives. You only want spontaneously to benefit suffering sentient beings. So suffering sentient beings, like us peanuts, we can't possibly communicate with non-physical, you know, energies, too abstract. So what these kind Buddhas do is manifest in bodies that we as peanuts can see. One example is that Buddha, Mr. Buddha. We all look at the statue, you know. Go, oh, there's the Buddha, we'll say. Now, excuse me, go back to 2,500 years ago in India. The place was crawling in sadhus. They don't look the same. You wouldn't go, oh, there's the Buddha. You wouldn't recognize Buddha from anybody because it's a human body. Buddha doesn't need a body. It's not possible to recognize a Buddha. It's impossible. He would look like all the other sadhus. I promise you wouldn't have seen his hair curly like that. He's like a regular guy with his yellow thing on, bopping around like all the other Hindus teaching. You wouldn't have seen a Buddha. No way. Not possible. We're not clairvoyant. We can't see. So, but anyway, he's said to be this person, Mr. Shakyamuni, the Buddha whose teachings we're studying here, okay? So one form in which Buddha consciousness manifests is a human one. You could argue this is the equivalent of Jesus. Isn't it? They call him God made man. Isn't God manifests as a human? Well, the difference is Buddhism says here, Buddhas are manifesting in trillions of forms. Like a dog here, an ant there, an old ugly homeless person down the road, that wacko around the corner. You can't tell. They say in the teachings, in the Mahayana teachings, you don't know who anybody is, so do not judge. So Buddhas will manifest in any form that will be of benefit to sentient beings, in whatever way is necessary for that sentient being. And there are countless of these forms, and they might look like holy people. There's this wonderful story about His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So you know, if you've been a Buddhist, they all say the Dalai Lama is a Buddha. Now, I cannot possibly tell you if that's true. Unless you're a Buddha yourself, you can't either. But you can certainly have confidence. Good enough. Nothing wrong with that. But you can't tell. But you can certainly tell he's a nice person. Anybody's met him? Well, of course, if you're a Chinese communist, you can't stand the sight of him. He's an evil splicist, isn't he, you know? But if we like him, and millions of people on this earth do like him, we can see he's a nice person, you know? Funny, cracks jokes, kind, seems to be quite knowledgeable. You can certainly seem to say he puts his money where his mouth is, right? So, okay, let's just say it's true that he is a Buddha. Let's just say that, okay? That means omniscient, infinite power, infinite empathy, and that also means this, and this is where it also sounds so cosmic to us, at this moment in time, and this is the capacity of a Buddha, they effortlessly are capable of manifesting in trillions of forms throughout space simultaneously to benefit countless sentient beings. Okay? When I first heard all these teachings, I thought these people were insane. And they were saying it with a straight face. Well, I can say it with a straight face now, because it seems to me coherent from what I've studied. But I'm just saying it. It's my working hypothesis, okay? So I'll tell you what they say. Okay, so now, there's this lovely story. I love to tell this story. In the early 60s, several years after the Tibetans had escaped from their country, as you know, driven out by the Chinese took over in about 1950 something, and then in 59 the Tibetans had an uprising, but they were completely hopeless and failed. They didn't have any guns. A few people tried to do something, but it was a bit useless. They didn't have an army or anything, so they were pretty hopeless, so they left. And the Dalai Lama left, okay? So then, of course, the Dalai Lama and many of the high lamas were frantic, desperate to get land so they could build their monasteries, so they could carry on the living lineages of all the teachings and practices before all the old lamas passed away. So they were negotiating with the Indian government. And the Indian government, how kind, this poor country, that finally offered hundreds of thousands of acres of forest right down south, which is now like little Tibet down there, you know? So anyway, it was right at the time of the negotiating. And His Holiness had his exiled government in Dharamsala, which is about 12 hours north of Delhi, which is where the Indian government, you know, places are. So His Holiness had sent down his Tibetan minister to discuss with the appropriate Indian minister. But he couldn't get a meeting. He got really frustrated, the poor Tibetan. We all know about bureaucracy in India, don't we? If you're Indian, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, bureaucracy. They say bureaucracy is quite strong in India. We know it is. Whatever. So anyway, he got a bit frustrated and went back up to Dharamsala and told His Holiness I couldn't get a meeting. It was impossible. And His Holiness, I mean, this is really just, you know, how I'm telling the story. Don't worry, it's cool. Go right back down to Delhi. So he climbed on the train, took a 12-hour journey back down. You know, well, he had to first drive to Patankot, then he got the train, then he went down. Then he got to Delhi, got to the office of the Indian minister. And for some reason that day, in the Indian minister's office, this little boy was with him. So the little boy was talking to the Tibetan, and the little boy expressed the wish for a dog. Well, the Tibetan was over the moon. He's happy to grease the wheels, you know. Oh, I'll get you a dog, he said. So he went outside, and there was a sadhu, a holy man, with a little dog. Oh, can I buy your dog? Yes. So he bought the dog, gave it to the little Indian boy. He was all so excited and happy. He went to his daddy. His daddy's all happy and appreciative, and everything works. They have a meeting and all things work, you know. So the point is, as Lama Zopa said, he told this story years ago, the sadhu and the dog were manifestations of the Dalai Lama's mind. So if he is a Buddha, then that's what they're capable of all the time. Even the lowest level bodhisattva, and there are 10 stages of development, apparently can manifest their mind in 100 forms simultaneously. And we're talking about all kinds of forms, but here we're talking about forms that we can see. So clearly a dog can't, you can't sit there and say, please would you give me teachings, Mr. Dog. Dog is not capable. But the point is this too. If, you see, we see the Dalai Lama and we go, oh, there's the Buddha. Excuse me, Buddhas don't need bodies. They've gone way past needing bodies. It's only out of their compassion that he manifests even as a human. A human body, by definition, is the product, indeed, of virtue. It's better than a dog's one, but it's a product of attachment. So clearly, if he's a Buddha, he hasn't got attachment. He doesn't need a human body, but he chooses to take a human body for people like you and me so we can communicate. So the same with the sadhu and the dog. So the Buddhas are bopping around, according to this way of seeing the world, facilitating things. So that sadhu, if he was the Buddha, or that dog, if he was the Buddha, it doesn't mean he had to be born in a dog's womb. He could have just the Buddha's mind can just manifest right there as a dog. Now the point is this. We go, oh, well, it must have been a special dog. I'm sure he could realize it was a special dog, you know. Like we all think about our dogs. They're all holy because they like to sit with them and meditate. No. It could have been a really mean, ugly dog. Because the Buddha's manifesting to teach the boy a lesson. Who knows? It doesn't have to be a cute dog. It wouldn't be a dog with a halo. It wouldn't be saying, wink, wink, I'm really the Dalai Lama. No. It's a dog. It will look like a dog. It will eat like a dog. It will pee like a dog. It will die like a dog. But it ain't a dog. Dalai Lama's not a human. God, this is the teachings. And this is all the Mahayana teachings. And if we study this, it's just weird and wacko stuff. Even if you do study it, it's weird and wacko. But it's my working hypothesis, okay? So the point is this. The Buddhas are never stopping helping facilitate. Clearly, who we can never judge who anybody is, if this is the case, you know? If this is the case. It's kind of outrageous. And so we've got to understand at least the Bodhisattva teachings to understand this. It's kind of cosmic. Understand the logic of it. Understand what the mind is, what it's capable of, what we can do as you progress spiritually, how you have the power to do such things as this, to manifest your mind as a dog when it's necessary to help sentient beings. So that means, of course, that little boy, but he's feeding the dog and loving the dog and being kind to the dog. He's been kind to the Buddha. You know? So anyway, the Buddhas manifest in ordinary forms to help sentient beings, as well as holy forms like the Dalai Lama to teach us. Now the point is, getting to the point now. And there's another form in which the Buddha mind manifests, but this is in a subtle light body form that regular people like you and me can't see. That particularly the Arya Bodhisattvas, the holy being Bodhisattvas who realize emptiness, this form of the Buddha, this is called the Sutra teachings, manifests in the dreams and the meditation of that holy being. When you've accessed your subtle consciousness, the subtle consciousness, when you're capable, can cognize the Buddha at that level. Okay? The subtle form in which the Buddha manifests to benefit sentient beings. So, these Buddhas... Okay, now another way to look at it all. There's, do a little family tree. There's Buddha, consciousness, pure unmanifest consciousness. Buddha, real meaning of Buddha. Then you go down and you have Rupa. The term here is the Sanskrit Dharmakaya, which you've heard. It technically means truth body. It's referring to enlightened consciousness. Then you go down and you've got Rupakaya, form body. Then you have two of these. Nirmanakaya, which means emanation body. Sambhogakaya, which means enjoyment body. Okay. So, in sutra teachings, you've got Shakyamuni Buddha, the monk. He represents the subduing of the body, speech and mind. Just look at the image of a Buddha and you can see immediately what he represents is the controlling of the body, speech and mind. This is the first level of practice. Then we've got, if you like, another way of looking at this now, we've got Buddha in the advanced teachings, in the Bodhisattva aspect, and this is the one from the Vajrayana or Tantrayana, and you see in this kind of light body form, and it's known as Vajradhara. He's like the tantric aspect of Buddha. But under him, you've got the five Buddha families. And there's Amitabha, other Buddhas. And they each, all of these manifestations, these thousands of forms of the Buddha, but in light body forms, which the Arya beings can see, which we then visualize in our meditations. It's just like psychology. They all represent different psychological states, okay? That's all they represent. So these Buddhas, at this form, at this level, also manifest at a subtle level an environment in which they function. And usually, and these are called pure lands. This is not the same as God realm. If you know about samsara, the top suburb in samsara is called God realms, which have light bodies, but they're still in samsara. They're still in samsara. There's not much use, it's wasting time to go there. because you haven't realized emptiness. You haven't cleaned up all the delusions. Then you've got these other ones, these Buddha lands, pure lands, which are different kettle of fish. And mostly, to get born in these types of environments where you can have teachings directly from the Buddha and which you can have a light body and get enlightened very quickly, you've got to be highly realized. So there's this little section in this book called We Must Pray to Go to Amitabha's Pure Land. So let me read you about that. So all I know is before this book, I had no interest in boring old Amitabha's Pure Land. And I thought, oh, these Chinese Buddhists, I'm talking about, I'm a Tibetan Gelugpa, blah, 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 you know. So then when I, remember, a couple before I'd finished the book, Holly, his attendant, sent me a note saying Rinpoche had given an initiation into Amitabha's Pure Land. Into Amitabha's practice. And she sent me the commentary about going, so I'll read you what he said. And I'm a complete fan now. I'm buying a ticket to Amitabha's Pure Land. I'm packing my bags to go to Amitabha's Pure Land. Then I think if I miss the plane, I'll get a human body instead, so that'll be okay. Aim for the best. So let me just read you what he says.
Which chapter?
It's chapter, it's a different section, the way I've got it. It's in chapter 1, How to Think About Death and Reincarnation, and it's like one of the sections there called Pray to Be Reborn in Amitabha's Pure Land. 38. Okay? So let's see what he says. Okay. In order to achieve enlightenment quickly for sentient beings, not for yourself, for sentient beings, we need to make sure we go to a pure land after we die. Guru Rinpoche Padmasambhava mentions this, and in many of his teachings, Lama Tsongkhapa says we should pray to be born, especially in Amitabha's pure land. I mean, what I'm reading here, the editing in there is probably a bit different. Wisdom changed a lot of things from what I did. Never mind. So we born at Dewa Chen in Tibetan or Sukhavati in Sanskrit. Lama Tsongkhapa says we should want to be born. So I'll say even what prayer means in a minute. I'll explain. Which means you should want to go there. You should aspire to go there. You should intend to go there. Because it's easy for us ordinary people, those with delusions, to be born there. I was surprised by that, Lama Zopa says. So, there are numberless pure lands where you can practice Tantra and achieve enlightenment. There's Vajrayoginis and Haruka's pure lands where you can definitely become enlightened. And Tushita, Maitreya Buddha's pure land. And of course you can pray to be born in Shambhala, which is a place related to Kala Chakra. However, to be born in many of these pure lands is very difficult. For some, you need to have achieved the eighth level of the Mahayana path. To be reborn in the lowest pure lands, you need to have cut the ego, the ignorance holding the I as truly existent. You need to have actualized the happiness, the bliss, and the ultimate reality of no self. You would need to realize emptiness, in other words. And to be born in Tushita, you need to have very pure morality. So it's difficult. So if you don't have these realizations, even if you still have delusions, even if you pray to go to these pure lands, you won't succeed. So also, Uche says, you know, those who have delusions can be born here. And not only that, according to my root guru, Trijang Rinpoche, you can practice Tantra and become enlightened there. It's also said that you can get enlightened more quickly there. However, some lamas say you can't get enlightened. They have all these discussions, okay? But this is what he says. So anyway, it's because of... So the point is here. The point is this. So first of all, if you're a Buddhist, you're going to be studying a bit. It sounds abstract, talking about a pure land, you know. But some people like, some people not. But again, it's my working hypothesis. This is the way these Buddhas manifested subtle light bodies in subtle light environments. And then you see the... And this is the thing. Okay, this is where we now have to understand a bit better. My battery's running out. Okay. This is where we have to understand a little bit better. We'll go into more of the stuff all tomorrow. It's 10 to 4. We've got time. Excuse me, are there any questions so far? Or are you just completely lost and confused? Yes? Yes, Sharma?
Yes,
microphone. Yes.
Can you explain the Nirvana, how this is related?
Okay, I will, exactly. Okay, good, thank you. So in general, you can say there's two main goals in Buddhism. There's this nice analogy, a bird needs two wings. And so the Mahayana view, the Bodhisattva view, is this one, the one goal is Buddhahood. And that has the two wings, wisdom and compassion. the two together. That's the final goal of Buddhahood. So you could, then you've got the other goal, which, you know, if you graduate at the wisdom wing, that's the goal of the Theravadan practitioners in Thailand and Malaysia. Their goal is to get themselves out of samsara. The Mahayana one is you get yourself out of samsara and you're qualified to help others get out of samsara. So there's the nirvana, I think, just means cessation. I think. Right? Mrs.? Cessation. Is that the meaning of the word nirvana? Isn't it? Who? Say what?
To my knowledge, yes.
Yeah, okay, her knowledge is, yeah. So cessation. So it's when you've achieved the first level of nirvana, which is the nirvana of your liberation from suffering, which means at some point you've realized emptiness, you've cut the self, you've cut the root of delusions, and then over several lives you've perfected and removed all the other delusions, and now you've achieved in some life or other, you will achieve your personal liberation. You're still going to live around, you'll be a bopping around life in your human body, you'll be a blissful, amazing being, no longer ego, you'll have compassion, you'll have love, but when you die, your compassion and love for others overrides your bliss and your wish to get the hell out of samsara overrides your love and compassion, and you will zap into a subtle state of bliss. The Theravadins say you'll disappear altogether, but the Mahayanas argue with that. But generally, the Mahayanas would say you go to a subtle state of bliss, you finish samsara, you don't need to come back, and then one day Buddha will come along and tap you on the shoulder, say, okay, honey, stop wasting time, come onto the Mahayana path now and become a Buddha. So now the other nirvana is the nirvana of the cessation of suffering and its causes, and even the subtlest imprints, all the delusions even that prevent you from being an omniscient person. That's also the cessation as well. That's also another nirvana, but the more advanced one. So it's not a place like, it's not an equivalent of heaven at all. Not like that. It's really a word to refer to your state of being, of having rid yourself of suffering. So it's actually not a place. Not at all. Are we communicating? That's the meaning of nirvana. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, okay. Okay. So, okay, what was I going to say? Something about something. What was it? Huh? Yeah, I know. Back to Amitabha, and then back to understanding more the way the mind is, I think I was going to say. I can't remember now. Never mind, were there any other questions first? Yes.
This is more a point of clarification than a question.
Okay.
But I was wondering about with dying on the animal skins. What about feather pillows and down comforters and things like that?
Technically speaking, that's animals, isn't it? It's very interesting. It's a good point. Technically, they don't mention that because they didn't have down comforters in Tibet, did they? But anything related to animals, it could be... It's a good point. Never thought of a feather comforter. Thank you very much. It's very helpful. Could be complicated, could be difficult because it's about animals and because of the energy of animals, which could be kind of not being mean about animals, we love animals, but the energy of their minds, if it's connected to their body, it could be influential. You know, it's true. It's a very good point. Thank you. I never thought of feather pillows. Must mention to Rinpoche. He might mention it next time. Good point. Thank you. Yeah. Yes.
So how, I'm just like, part of me is skeptical. How is all this? These pure lands, do
yes.
these highly realized beings come back from these places? And is this jotted down somewhere, told to people? I mean,
okay, you mean where's all this information come from?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Crazy.
Good question. Okay, listen. Okay. If you just go to the cooking section in the bookstore, right, and you go to and you find a recipe book, right? So you have to deduce, do you not, that this information in this book is coming from where? Where would this information come from?
Someone who's cooked.
Someone's mind.
Right.
It's experiential knowledge, isn't it? Now, that person might be completely lying, it's possible, and stolen it all. It still might be valid, but maybe they've stolen it. That's a possibility. They might have made it all up and just made up their fantasies. And they wouldn't last long because all the proper cooks would chuck them out. Or they would be respectful and say, I'm not a very good cook, but this is my master's cooking. That's a possibility too, isn't it? Now, what's fascinating about spiritual, nobody asks anybody to prove their source. Because you know why? Because we're addicted to the view that everybody's allowed to think what they like. And religion is not to be proved. It's all just belief. You have to prove anything. And you're going to see there's so much, in my opinion, garbage published as even Buddhist spiritual. People go to a course for 1 month and they write a book. Oh, no one said it the way I understand. I'm going to write a book. Every second Westerner writes a book about their latest experiences about Buddhism. See, and everybody has a different wrong interpretations, but nobody questions them on it. Whereas cooking, you'd be thrown out it, you wouldn't even get a publisher. Because we demand rigor and proof. So it's shocking, actually, in spiritual. So if it is true, if what we're discussing here, and all I can tell you is, I've learned this from my teachers. They've got it from their teachers. They're all the same family as the Dalai Lama, all these uncles and aunties I've got, you know, all from the same big mob. So I'm telling you, I'm passing on their information. I haven't realized this stuff. I've got some intellectual understanding of this stuff. I take it as my hypothesis until I prove it wrong. So I'm happy to say it's my hypothesis. But I'm going to have to track back to the sources I've got this stuff from, which is Lamasov Rinpoche. He got it from his gurus. So it's got to, you've got to look at the sources, and then you've got to recognize it. It's either made up, or it's valid experiences of actual real cooks, actual yogis who have seen this. Otherwise, it's just speculation.
But would it be passed down, say, from Shakyamuni Buddha to...
Shakyamuni Buddha taught in a human form certain teachings, and this way it gets more difficult for us. Many of the teachings, the Vajrayana teachings, many of the Mahayana teachings, were given at a subtle level by the Buddha in the to the minds of holy beings. So you've got to even posit the possibility of those subtle levels of mind.
So it wouldn't be similar to, say, someone who is... taken the teachings from the Bible and transcribe them and say that scribe made an error in one or two words that changed the meaning of a sentence. Can you still apply that with Buddhist teachings or not?
What do you mean, darling? I'm confused.
When the Buddha taught...
So Shakyamuni, wait a minute, stop right here. Okay. First of all, Shakyamuni Buddha, in the human form, taught certain of his teachings. Many of his teachings, including many of the Mahayana and certainly the Vajrayana, were given in different levels of Buddha, in different levels of Buddha's subtle forms. So you've got to even posit the possibility of that here.
Okay.
So the point is, okay, let's just use music as an example. My mother was a musician. She wasn't Mozart. Mozart's dead several hundred years. But my mother, and you look at the way we respect music in the classical music. Look at all the notations; they really take seriously. I remember reading an entire article in New York Times by some musician who's researched some text of who wrote that jazz thing, something of the blues, like an orchestral thing in the 30s.
Gershwin.
And there's in a part in there, the special car. He used car horns as an instrument, so that even the instrument makers now make these car horns in what they think is the particular key that Gershwin meant. And now there's this whole scholarly investigation into maybe he didn't mean that by his, he meant this, and so they now got different keys, and all the musicians are arguing what Gershwin meant. So we take it seriously, the lineages, right? It's the same with Buddhism. There's many interpretations. In the monasteries they have really big debates, the Theravadins, but there's nothing wrong with that. We're human, so there's got to be discussion, there's got to be debate, and so you look into all these things with a very open mind. You can't just keep it all simple. That's why it can't be fundamentalist. So when you respect the lineage and you go back from your teacher to yours to this to that, there's some kind of power source you're plugging into, but it's very complex. I mean, the literature in Buddhism that they study in the Tibetan monastic universities for 40 years is absolutely mind-boggling, the depth of it. Just the stuff on the mind alone is phenomenal. Do you understand? So it's a huge area of stuff, but it's treated with this incredible respect. And eventually, you know, the information has to come finally from a source that's actually experienced it. So my mother could be a valid musician and perfectly channel Mozart, you know, but Mozart's dead. But it can still be a valid person right now. Do you understand? Rather, the West, we just think anything goes, anybody is allowed to think what they like. I can believe what I like because we think of it as a belief system, which by definition means you don't have to prove it. And that's, in my opinion, shocking. Are we communicating?
Yes.
So if finally, and this is the point that Dalai Lama makes, trust Westerners a lot. I mean, keep it simple. You know, I'll give another analogy. Einstein comes here and he tells us about his findings about relativity. Now, we know it's his personal findings. We know he didn't have a revelation of it. We know he didn't make it up. We know he didn't have a vision or a dream, and we know he's not speculating. We might never even know that 1 + 1 = 2 yet, but we give him the respect, and we know it's from his own experience, and he's not believing us to, he's not asking us to believe him. So he says, okay, this is my findings, take it or leave it, it's your call, and here's my methodology. Go do it. Now you go prove it to yourself. But our problem, that's called science. But then we go, oh, relativity is science. Well, have you proven it? Oh, no, but somebody else has. But that's not science. Buddha is exactly the same. Buddha is identical. He has proved it to be true, what he is saying. Every word is said to be from his direct experiential knowledge. But that's science. But we don't think that in the West. But it's the same as Einstein. But it's not my science until I've proven it. It's just belief system. Everybody believes in relativity. Everybody believes in this and that. We think it's science because it's someone else's science. It's got to be my science. So then I've got to go through Buddha's methodology, Einstein's methodology. And at each step of the way with Einstein, we all do this. Each step, I tick the boxes. Oh, yeah, that's right. I've got that one right. I've got that one right. That's how you'll be a Buddhist. So each step of the way, I'm doing two things. I do what Buddha says, and then at some point, I will have an experience of it, and I'll verify it. That's the same with Einstein. And at some point, if you can discover that Einstein made a mistake, it'll be easier to prove it because you've been all the way, and then you point it out. He'll be the first person to be happy. Buddha's the same. So it's got to be experiential and verification, finally. So it's a tricky one, and intense, and subtle, and disciplined. Because Buddha's not a creator. In that sense, literally, this is not a belief system. Literally. So it's quite powerful, quite interesting. So it's really one step at a time, you know. So that means you can't, you know, I can't say, oh, I believe in Einstein. Who do you think? I mean, it'd be ridiculous. You've got to take it as your hypothesis. And then as you prove it, each step of the way it becomes yours, real truth. The same here. Identical.
Well, I guess my thing is, you know, anybody could take something and believe in it so much and then find ways of proving it.
Oh, I see. So you can do that with mathematics, can you? Don't be ridiculous.
No.
I'm talking about knowledge. Okay. I don't care whether you call it label, spiritual, or mathematical. It's the same logic. It's either true or it's not. And if you can influence numbers to make 1 + 1 = 4, I don't care how much you believe in it. You're a mad person. Because truth is truth. Reality is reality. Facts are facts. And Buddha's deal is about facts. You don't have to believe what he says is facts, but he's talking about this is facts. And this is the point for the Buddha. It's not God's truth. There's no such concept. And the fact with God's truth, you can't prove it. That would be considered the worst sin of arrogance. You must believe it. And I'm not complaining.
Right.
But not here. Buddha's either right or he's wrong, baby. We have to go real slow, one step at a time, with great humility, as it your working hypothesis, prepared for Buddha to be wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. But you can't just sit back on your laurels and believe in it. You can believe in mathematics till the cows come home. You'll never know how to use it, and it'll never change anything in you. This is the proper way to treat Buddhism. It's pretty intense. 99% of us won't do this because we're all intellectually lazy and we'd rather believe in it. So maybe that's better than nothing. At least we're believing in something that's not bad, not harmful. Do you understand?
Right.
But at some point, you've got to verify it for yourself. Otherwise, you won't get anywhere. You'll never graduate as Einstein. Do you understand?
Yes, I do. Thank
good.
You.
Okay.
So
you've got to have a very happy mind to want to have it as your working hypothesis. So I'm very happy to have this as my working hypothesis. I'm very happy to blow on about Buddhism, but I say it's my working hypothesis. What choice do I have, you know? What, sweetheart?
I was curious about the terminology. Is there a difference in when Buddha was here and living as a human, those teachings, is that the Pali Canon or, you know,
I don't know if
term?
It's the Pali Canon, but I don't know that. I can't tell you that exactly, but I do know there are the various Buddha teachers at various levels, which I'm trying to get a head around this idea that consciousness can manifest in subtle forms, which of course is not visible to our eyes. So it's hard. You've got to take it as a hypothesis. That's why the more you understand the Buddha's teachings about the mind, the more we can theoretically imagine how it can manifest in a subtler form.
So somewhere there's some scholar that can take all these teachings and every little bit of it, trace it back to whether to where it came from originally?
No, it's very hard because some of the teachings what Buddha gave in a subtle form, so you're not going to find texts anywhere.
That's the ones I have a harder time with.
Well, of course you do, but this is your hypothesis, darling. Yeah. Relax. It's okay. Relax. Our minds are very capable. So you have to decide what you want to take as your working hypothesis. Stop trying to squeeze it into yourself and prove it this second. That's trying to get, I use a good example of like another one is acupuncture. You know, 50 years ago in this town, if you said you stuck needles in people to heal them, you'd be put in prison. I mean, you get my point now. So it's a real weird, wacky idea initially because it's the opposite of what you're used to thinking. I mean, you say you have a trouble with this, but you believe all the scientific stuff without question, don't you?
Actually, not acupuncture.
No, I'm not discussing acupuncture. Wait. What I'm getting at, I haven't finished my story yet. But could you accept that you brought up that your mind is your brain? You accepted that, didn't you? You never tried to prove it, did you? You never tried to prove it, did you? You accepted it, didn't you? You accepted it. Come on, girl. You become a scientist and proves it's your brain, proves it's your mind. Excuse me.
No, I can't prove it. There's no way to prove it.
Excuse me. If there's not, then it doesn't exist. It's a load of superstitious garbage. Of course there's a way to prove it or disprove it. If it's true, it's true, and you'll prove it. If it's not, you'll prove it. It's not true.
Well, then I can only prove it to myself, not to anyone else.
No, total load of nonsense. Yeah, that's fine, but you're missing the point here. Let's start with acupuncture to answer your point. Okay. You've never heard about it. Not ever once. And then suddenly, and you're living, default mode is the allopathic system, which you've taken for granted. And you haven't studied it, but honey, you believe in it, like most of us. We mostly believe what we're told. Nobody ever has questioned whether their mother made them. Everybody believes it. No one ever questions whether their brain is their mind. We all believe it. Just like a Christian believes in God. But the worst part is materialists don't think they believe in anything, which is beyond shocking. Not most materialists have not proven the brain, have not proven anything. They just believe it because somebody else is said to have proved it. So we're all walking around with belief systems, first of all, okay? So there you are with allopathic system belief. And then you hear these weird wacko people put needles in. Then you keep hearing about it. So your mind starts to shake a bit. And you think, well, maybe there's a possibility. That's interesting. So I might have a mind that'll try to look into the possibility here. So then what you're going to do is you're going to look into it, check up, hear some people, and then you decide before you know anything yet, you think it's reasonable and it's worth taking as your hypothesis. So you can't begin to study it, can you, until you accept it as a hypothesis. Because every time you hear put the needle there, you go, don't be ridiculous, what are you talking about? You can't study it. You've got to open your mind to the possibility that there could be something valid there. Would you agree that's how you study acupuncture?
So far,
one step at a time. So
of
now
course.
You haven't... Pardon? You accept
yes.
So far. So you haven't proven a thing yet. You've still got a bunch of theories. But as you keep studying, each step of the way, one more piece of the puzzle will fit in, won't it? And we're still talking intellectual here. You haven't put needles in anybody yet. But you're suddenly going to get... And this is my point now. This is my point. If acupuncture... or indeed anything else, is a valid, and this is my word, system. Whereas we think of spiritual as random, weird moments of some special vision. We don't think of it as a valid system, ever. But if acupuncture is a valid system, it's got to be coherent first, intellectually. You've got to be able to pass your exam intellectually. So intellectually it's got to be coherent. Intellectually it's got to be coherent in its own self, this entire model. It has to be intellectually coherent before you stick a needle in anybody. And the same with Buddhism. If it's a valid system, sweetheart. If it's a valid system, and I mean the word system, not just a random series of weird things, which is what people think is spiritual. It's got to be a totally coherent, and Buddhism in fact is a study in the Tibetan monastic university as an entire worldview. So then it has to be coherent intellectually. And I can say to you, I know a little bit intellectually. And I'm content, so far so good. I'm very prepared for it to be wrong. I don't mind, but I'm having fun on the way. What else can we do? We try to squeeze it in, like you say, oh, I have difficulty with that. Don't have to have difficulty. Just posit it and try and study what the mind is, study what they say, study what they say, their hypothesis, study what they say intellectually, and then intellectually it fits. Intellectually it works in this model of what the mind is and how there can be subtle this. But you've got to study it first. Okay. Can you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Did you want to?
Yes, that's very meta. Thank you.
Very who?
Meta.
What's that mean?
You tend to answer a little specific question and include everything. So that's cool.
That's good.
But yeah, there are some. I'm not going to get into it because it's my personal dilemma on my path. So
but where's your
thank
what
you.
Dilemma then? What dilemma? You just said, it's like we didn't have the conversation. Why have you got a dilemma?
Oh. I have...
It's a good discussion. Everybody has things like this. So it's perfect. We all do. So it's really good discussion, I think, isn't it? Or is it boring? Go on, talk.
Okay.
What's your dilemma?
I came in with the belief system of the scientific method. I am a scientist. I work with scientists. You know, I don't believe things unless there's a double-blind study that proves it, and it's been repeated numerous times.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Exactly.
That's why, actually. But then, of course, like you say, there is anecdotal evidence that acupuncture works for some people, which kind of blows my mind, and I still haven't figured out. So for me personally, the jury's out on that.
But wait a minute. Stop right there. What do you mean anecdotal evidence? What the hell are you talking about?
Case studies. Ones that been repeated.
Excuse me. You know, you're still talking from the assumption that allopathic is truth, and that's arrogant. What you've got to do is put aside allopathic completely and see it as one model of the world that describes health. And then you've got to open your mind to the possibility with 100% enthusiasm to look into this Chinese one, the acupuncture one, to see even intellectually if it's coherent. I don't care about tests and that. I'm talking about you personally engaging in a system intellectually to see if there's even intellectual coherence there. Not just taking a few bits of other people's evidence. That's not nearly enough. That's not what I'm talking about at all. So the equivalent here is, you've got a scientific view that you is your belief system, and you've done this and this and this. So here we're talking about Buddha's view, which is fundamentally different series of assumptions of what mind is, where we come from, fundamental different series of assumptions. So the only way you can look into Buddhism is put aside in one part of your mind this one, and then look completely freshly, like learning a new language. What is mind? What is this? What is that? What is this? Without keeping arguing with the other one, because you're going to bump into yourself. Just relax about it. Completely relax about it. And then look into this other one, but just as a hypothesis. Not to believe it, not to square all the dots, not to make it all tied up and neat. But relax about it. Big view, big picture. Well, then you have no dilemma.
About
then.
That, I
just
am.
Just wait a minute, then you have no dilemma. Just be humble and patient and go one step at a time. There's no dilemma then.
Oh.
There isn't. That means that you say I have a problem with that. That means you haven't studied it enough yet. So just study it, darling, and get eager and excited. Oh, good. I now I'm going to look into how mind can manifest in subtle forms. That's a fascinating new area of study I'd like to look at. That's not a dilemma at all.
Well, I studied up on rebirth looking. I looked desperately. It was 5 years before I was able to take refuge and feel good about it because a lot of the
good
evidence
darling.
That people sent me, oh, look at this, and I did look it up, and...
Yes.
Good. It's,
but
so
you've got to study it way more, darling, to really get
I am. It's still a hypothesis,
of course,
but it's very
excuse
difficult.
Excuse me, honey, until you hardly realize it's going to be a hypothesis. Don't hold your breath, Petal. Do you see my point?
Yes, I do.
Until you've got clairvoyance, reincarnation and karma is a hypothesis. And that you can get it. Buddha's got all the techniques there. Hindus did it. So all the techniques are there. And most of us in this life won't get it because you've got to go off into the mountains for several years, you know, give up sex, drugs and rock and roll. But you've got to look at the theories first to know it's possible to get clairvoyance. And then you know it's possible. That's when you'll see the karma is true or not. And if you discover that Buddha's wrong, you had a fine time, but now you say, goodbye, Buddha. Thanks very much, but goodbye.
But does that mean every single thing, like I... In science, everything that's been proved, everything
by
conventionally...
Other people. Not by
I have
you.
To, so if I want to get, if I need heart surgery, I have to look it up
no,
and
you
learn
can have,
how to
no,
be a cardiologist?
No. You can trust your source. You can have faith.
Okay.
You can have faith, baby.
But my faith is backed by evidence.
Well, so is this. No difference. Not a millifraction of difference. And if there is, it's superstition. It's garbage. If there's not evidence, but you haven't proven that evidence... You have to okay.
I'm starting to get
evidence
it, yeah.
would be it is more subtle evidence when you have to see a person who's got realizations. That's hard to see because we can't talk about external ones. Only talking about internal. So you've got to really still it's the same, but really it's the same process. The same, and there's nothing wrong with having confidence in your heart doctor. There's nothing wrong with having confidence in the Dalai Lama if he gives you advice because you've decided you're going to trust him. There's nothing wrong with that. But at some point, if you want to do it to help others, you've got to learn to be a heart surgeon yourself. So at some point you want to become a Buddha like the Dalai Lama and advise others, you've got to do it yourself.
Yep.
So we go different these pieces at different times, you know?
So I may be testing it like gold, but I may not find out my answer till I'm a Buddha.
No, I didn't say that at all. No, because it's gradual. You don't wait till you're perfect to get the answers. You get answer at this point. You get junior school answer, grade 3 answer, grade 4 answer, and it's progressive and incremental.
Yeah, my path isn't linear, but I'm trying.
Oh, okay, it has to be linear. Of course it's linear. There's no other way. Excuse me.
In a colloquial way, not in a world.
You mean you've done high school knowledge before you did junior school knowledge? I don't think so. You've realized certain level of music, but you can't even play grade 2 yet. I don't think so, darling. Okay. I think you're.
Oh, I just get confused because with Tibetan Buddhism, there's so many different practices, and it's hard to know. They don't say, okay, we're going to do single-pointed meditation. And then when you have that, we're going to move on, and then we're going to do this.
No, that's ridiculous.
There's a lot of different things at once.
No, that's ridiculous. You wouldn't do it that way. You wouldn't do it that way.
So it kind of feels like sometimes I'm going off in one direction, doing the Vajrasattva stuff, and then sometimes...
Because you can't see all the pieces fit together.
Yeah, there's a lot of pieces.
But are you a little girl or something? You want it simple? Remember the goal? Your mind, mm-hmm. become a Buddha, pervade the universe, know all the minds of all beings, all past, all future, all present, to know all their karma perfectly, to manifest your mind in billions of forms throughout space for billions of years for billions of sentient beings. Yes. You want a simple method for that? Be patient, honey.
Okay, thank you. I'll find out what's best for me with time. Thank you.
Exactly. 4:15, I'm sorry. Yes, go on.
When you were talking about Dharmakaya, you mentioned
subtle. It's enlightened consciousness without body. Yeah, awareness, pure omniscient awareness.
That brought to mind a question that you, I think you might have answered.
Yes,
you said something about if Venerable Tendrin is a Buddha and you are a Buddha, you could argue that there's one
Buddha. Yeah, that's right.
I don't. Can you expound on that?
No, nothing to say. Just have to think about it. As Lama Zopa said, it's like the Christian teaching, there's one God, but there's billions of emanations.
Okay.
Billions of forms. Because the idea of there being Dharmakaya pervading space, knowing everything, is not a dualistic concept. We only think dualistic, and this is even too abstract, even here there's words. Us have separate beings. The biggest mistake is even that we've got separate minds, and that's because of delusions. So when you're enlightened, it's not possible to have a separate mind. Impossible. Impossible, darling. This idea of separate people is because of delusions. The final dualism to go is the experience of no subject object and no separateness between you and everybody else. Impossible. This itself is a dualism. All the realms of existence, all the separate eyes, all because of delusions. It's pretty abstract, darling. It's us.
Well, I will think about that.
I know.
Thank you.
What can we do? Any questions about death? Back to the topic. And all this is part of it, you know. And we're talking about Amitabha's Pure Land mostly, wasn't it? All this got started with that. Go on, yes.
It's not about death, it's actually about life. Does genealogy, heredity, play any role in the acquisition of the world?
No, not at all.
Okay.
That's complete nonsense. Okay. What's your name?
Physical.
I know, darling. What's your name?
Not the physical, but the mind. Tad.
Who?
Tad.
Tad. Okay, there's Tad. And Tad has a mummy and daddy. And then they had mummies and daddies, and you go back to the monkeys, right? If we track back, right, we'll go back to the monkeys, don't we? Okay, so Tad has a body, and he came out of mummy's body. So let's say mummy's got a gene that, or whatever it is that causes you to have, you know, like twisted feet or something. It's perfectly possible, isn't it? Let's just say. So then it is a physical thing. But the Buddhist view of karma is that due to your past actions, mental and physical, you created the cause due to certain negative karma of kicking people all the time, just a say, to get born in a body with a mummy who will give you crooked toes. So they are crooked toes, and your grandma had them, and your great-grandpa had them, but you created the cause to get born into that family because of the action you did, which is similar to what they did to have crooked toes as well. You see my point?
I do.
There you go. Does that answer it?
It does.
Okay, thank you. Okay, good. Anybody else? So it is a condition, and it plays a role. And depends on how powerful that thing is. Maybe if you can get your toes fixed, then you can fix that karma. But some karmas are so strong. Like, what's the one? Hemophilia, when boys have hemophilia. They bleed, don't they? That's maybe hard to fix. It's a really intense condition that is very hard to overcome, you know? Do you understand? But still physical, but you created the cause due to karma to get that condition. That's the thing. Do you see? Yeah. Anybody else? Questions? No questions. Okay, let's get back on track. I'm sorry. Okay. So the whole reason I'm bringing up Avatapa's Pure Land, try to give a bigger picture to it than just rather than just say the words to you, is to try and get our head around the possibility that consciousness, which is not physical, as it gets more enlightened, more advanced, can manifest in subtler forms. That's what I'm trying to get at. You know, this possibility, that's all, which of course doesn't fit with the materialist view. So therefore, the point of wanting to be born in that type of realm after you die is because it's an environment in which you won't have gross body, if you can imagine that. Therefore, you won't have gross delusions. Therefore, it'll be really easy to hear teachings and get enlightened. It'll be unhindered. And then the whole point is you go there with a Mahayana wish, you get these realizations, and then you can come back to the human realm and bop around and help others. That's the whole point of it. Are we communicating here? Otherwise, if you're a Buddhist, the only option, there's one option only for the type of rebirth you want, which is a human body. Why? Because a human, we've got the miracle of a human life, if we're fortunate, is access to our virtue, access to intelligence. So that's the type of mind we want to access. We've all got the delusions. We've all got access to attachment and anger and jealousy and all the rubbish and the craving for sex and craving for food and sleep and all that stuff, which actually are animal minds. That we share those with animals. We can see that. Buddhist psychology refers to all beings, not just humans, you know. So as a human, our saving grace is our virtues. And that's the perfect. It's the best of a bad lot, in other words, you know. Within samsara, it's best to have a human. You can be born a bird. Okay, I'll put it this way. If you want to have a long neck, it is really best to be a giraffe. So find out whatever causes that and you'll get a long neck. If you really want to have, you know, fly cheap, be a bird. But if you want to work on your mind and access intelligence and work things out and get rid of delusions and become this marvelous being full of bliss and clarity and wisdom and compassion, best to be a human. The best of a bad lot. That's really the way to put it, you know? Do you understand? Because you can use your intelligence. And that is our saving grace. And that's what's so difficult for us. We can see that. You know, our attachment, our anger, our laziness, all our rubbish, are the massive hindrances that prevent us from having enthusiasm, for wanting to grow virtue and grow our marvelous wisdom, you know. Are we communicating? Yes. Mm-hmm. Talk. We'll go back to the practices, and then it's 4:20. It's only time to go home. And then we'll do more tomorrow, okay. Yes, sweetheart.
So my question is,
yes.
Pure Land, do you see that as a place?
Okay, it's a really good question. Okay, so we have to, that means, okay, more analysis here. I'm sorry, more theorizing, more philosophizing. Okay, this is so difficult, so interesting, so fascinating.
Well, because Nirvana is not a place. So
no, okay, listen, darling, listen. Okay. No, it's a totally perfect question. All right. We've got conventional truth, and there's what they call ultimate truth, okay?
Right.
Conventional reality, ultimate reality, if you like. So, conventional is the term that's used to refer to the world as we know it. As we know it, it's a say for us. That means we have a thing called a place. We know it takes 5 minutes to get from that place to this place. We talk like this, don't we? And we all have, because we know the meaning of these words, we then can convey, we have a feeling, it's only 5 minutes away, we can remember the feeling of how long it takes to get from one place to another in 5 minutes. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. So this is a truth, relatively speaking.
Right, but it's also
Please, let me finish. I'm just beginning this long conversation now. Beginning this long conversation. I'll try and make it short. So, relatively speaking, we can say, having this human mind embodied in this bag of bones, right, that we can accept 5 minutes, go from here to there. They're all, finally, concepts. I don't exaggerate now. I'm saying there's a thought called 5 minutes. There's a thought called a place. There's a thought called it goes from here. There's a thought called walk. There's a thought called drive. These are all concepts that we live according to. Do you agree with this? And we've given
yes.
meaning to these concepts, haven't we? So they take on meaning for us. So then we think of it, and then, now this is the part that's really difficult. Buddha's saying, conventionally speaking, you are a human. 5 minutes is 5 minutes. A place is a place. A house is a house. Kaka is kaka. Good is good. Bad is bad. Conventionally. But our problem, Buddha says, is because of this primordial ego grasping, this primordial root delusion deep in our bones that we don't even have a name for in our culture, is instinctively and primordially imposing upon those conventional truths some absolute certainty and concreteness on top of them that they just don't contain. So there is a place conventionally called Raleigh. There is a place conventionally called Australia. We see the shape, we see the map, we know how far to get there, take an aeroplane. And so within that relative reality, but at a subtler level, there is a place called Amitabha's Pure Land. There is a place, Buddha says, conventionally speaking, called Hell Realms. But you can't fly in an aeroplane from this place to a hell. You can't fly in an aeroplane of this place to Amitabha's Pure Land. They're literally the manifestation of different levels of consciousness. They're all the same consciousness. You can, so when you die, even for example, when you die, what's your name?
Clarissa.
Clarissa. Clarissa.
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you. So Clarissa dies in Raleigh. Her consciousness, along with the subtle wind energy, according to this model, will leave the body and will immediately be in a place called an intermediate state. No one can visit you there, baby, because it's your mental karmic creation. Literally. Now, this human realm is also your mental karmic creation that you happen to share with a lot of us because we've all done similar things karmically. But if you had a person in this room who's we call hallucinating and is seeing worms come out of your eyes, that's due to their past negative karma. They can have a similar karma as us to be in this room in Raleigh, but due to their other karma, they're seeing worms out of your eyes. So conventionally we can say there aren't any worms, but this, as far as this person is concerned, they're seeing worms coming out. They're seeing you as a devil. And everybody is doing this all the time with our concepts. And then, of course, we believe that whatever we see is true. So all Buddha's saying is the more you study emptiness, the more you get loosen the grip of this fundamentalism of this is real. Nevertheless, it still functions in that way according to your level of mind. They use this analogy. You got a glass. You could say you have some liquid in a container. A type of being called a spirit, who due to negative karma, especially craving karma, their mind is now conjoined with air energy. They're like a ghost. They flit from pillar to post. Their mind is tormented with dreadful, dreadful grasping. It's like being in a dream. You know, you think of something in a dream, you just go there. There's no climbing upstairs to go somewhere. There's no getting in aeroplanes to go there. There's no normal sense of space and time in our dreams, is there? It feels like another dimension, doesn't it? Because your mind is at a subtler level, experiencing your reality in a different way than the human conceptual sense of space and time. So they say the spirit's experience is like repulsive kaka and blood. A human will experience it as water. A god, a blissful being in the god realm, will experience as blissful nectar. We can even see that relatively with humans. One person eats a peanut and they die. It kills them. That's a relative reality for that person. Not in the peanut, because you can eat it and it'll make you healthy. So what's a peanut? Where's real? It's due to the karma. So we all see different things, we'll experience different things. So when you die, and then your new mummy and daddy are in Australia, you won't climb on an aeroplane to get there, baby. You'll be there in 1 millisecond. So what's space and time mean, if that's the case? So these things are relatively true, but there's no absolute truth to anything, in this sense. But it doesn't mean it's all loosey-goosey nothingness. So there's a real fine balance between understanding what conventional means and how things appear to us and what ultimate means. And this is slowly what we have to learn to understand.
Well, from an ultimate non-dualistic perspective, there is no place. So that's where
But there's no everything. Excuse me, you're chucking the baby out of the bathwater. From the ultimate point of view of understanding emptiness, there is a place called Raleigh. There is a place called Buddha, Buddha Amitabha's Pure Land. One is more gross, one is more subtle. They both have the same status conventionally as being conventional truths for the sentient beings experiencing them. Then you start to analyze them from the dualistic, the non-dualistic point of view, and you will not find one atom of anything in Amitabha's Pure Land that makes it inherently Amitabha's Pure Land. Equally, you will not find one atom of anything in Raleigh that makes it inherently Raleigh, because they're both merely labels. But as Tsongkhapa says, and this is where you put the two truths together, when you hear emptiness, what we feel is, well, there's no place, like you just said. So what you're really saying is there's nothing. That's nihilism, and it's not like that. But relatively, so Tsongkhapa says like this, this is wonderful the way he talks about it. When we finally understood, as Lama Zopa says, when we finally understood that there is not one atom, not one millisecond of an atom of anything in what we label Raleigh, from the side of Raleigh that makes it Raleigh. Not one atom. But nevertheless, conventionally, it functions exactly as Raleigh is defined. So it's like this smoke and mirrors. On the one side, as Lama Zopa says, they say there's nothing you can find here, but nevertheless, it does function. And these two have to fit together. So because when we hear emptiness, we can't help but hear nothing. And we become nihilistic and chuck the baby out with the bathwater. And the second we hear this Raleigh, we go, oh, thank God there is something. Grasp. This is the over-exaggeration of Raleigh, and this is the under-exaggeration of Raleigh. And reality is they mean the same thing. That conventional Raleigh does function, but you can't find anything in Raleigh ultimately. And this is the trickiest one, to get these two together.
So that you would say that therefore conventionally, there would be an Amitabha.
Of course, that's the point. Yes, that's the whole point. Yes, of course, that's the point. Yes, and there's a hell. That's what the yogis say. And if there isn't, then it's a lot of garbage. That's what Graham said at first, intellectually. The hypothesis. How's possible? And so I overdo it by trying to explain it, you know? And I'm probably too many things and blowing your poor minds. Or going blah, blah, too many words. Of course there is. If it's not, it's all a lot of garbage. It vomits. Throw it back at Buddha with a bomb. How dare he chuck his beliefs on top of us? That's outrageous. I wouldn't even talk about it if it doesn't exist. How outrageous of me. That is immoral of me. That's shocking. Throw me out and tear me from limb to limb. Are we communicating?
Yes, I think so. sometime I'd like to... Okay, yeah.
That's why I was trying to explain the theory of how it can exist. That means we've got to take on board the idea that mind is not physical. That's why we've got to take on board the idea there are different levels of elements. That's why if we talk about all the different realms of existence, for example, in samsara, a god is a person who, due to masses of virtuous energy, manifests after this body with their mind in a total state of bliss, and their four elements have manifested as light. So naturally, mind with a light body is blissful. And that's a space, a person with our eyes can't see it. But it's a reality for that person. Then you've got a person who, due to relative reality, but wants a nice spiritual practice, who wants a human body, they'll get a bag of bones. So we've got our reality. Then you've got a person further down, due to negative karma, due to very strong killing karma, gets born to a mummy's lion, a mummy lion womb. That's their reality. They see the ways that according to their reality, their mind's conjoined with this big bag of bones with the big claws. They see everything their view, their karmic appearance. Then you've got a person who's due to powerful grasping, their mind is conjoined with air energy, and they're like a ghost flitting from pillar to post. Then you have a person who, due to intense energy and anger and violence, because all our minds are conjoined with the four elements, their mind is literally conjoined with fire energy, with these intense nightmarish experiences called hell. They're each of them real states of mind that come along with a certain level of physicality. So then in that sense, you can't fit hell with Amitabha's Pure Land and Raleigh. They're different, like what the science fiction people say, they're different dimensions. They're different levels of mind. We've got to get our head around this. And then whatever and the point is this. When we say Israel a place, we see it as someone made me and plonked me in this place that looks like that. We see it as absolutely inherent from its own side. And guess what? I didn't ask to get born. And how dare someone give me this ugly place? Well, Buddha says, whatever you experience, as Lama Tso puts it, is the fruit of your past karma. You will experience it exactly according to the karma you call. So it'll appear beautiful, ugly, disgusting, harm you, kill you. That's your personal karmic appearance. So hell is like that. As Lama Yeshe said, hell is not some place that's made by God, which seems like. That the devil is in there waiting for Har, I'm waiting for Lama Yeshe. Hell is the manifestation of the negative energy of that suffering sentient being. And every realm, every place is that. It's the karmic appearance. In that sense, we each literally create Amitabha's Pure Land. We create our human realm. We create the hell realm. This is why it's not dualistic of God running the show, making hell, making heaven, and sending you there. Which is how we think and feel. Are we communicating?
Sure.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
So I want to create the cause of virtue to go to... I'd like to be around Amitabha, please, with a satellite body. No toilets, no diets, no bodies, no breast hanging about. Thank you very much. No weights, you know. So I can hang out, get completely blissful. Everything's radiant and blissful. Get masses of teachings as quick as possible. Become a Buddha and come back to humans and have fun. That's what I want to do. Okay. And help people. Hopefully help people. Do you understand? And my point is this. Let's say Buddha's wrong and I die and I turn into dust. Well, I won't mind, will I? It doesn't matter. Yeah, it's a win-win, you know. Who cares? And if the Christians are right and they'll punch me and send me to hell, then what can I do? I'll find out, won't I? I mean... Yeah, this is all big stuff, really. And everybody in the universe thinks, what is this? Why is this? Where is this? What's this? Buddha's just a particular system that answers these questions. And so I'm happy to work with Buddha's deal. That's all I'm trying to say. I'm happy to work with Buddha's as my hypothesis. You've got to take on one, you know, take on something. Otherwise, you can't do every one all at once unless you're a real genius. I can't do that. So I'm happy with Buddha for now. But I'm prepared for him to be wrong. That's okay. I'm not in a hurry. I'm enjoying myself. It's time to go home, folks. All right? So tomorrow we'll keep on going about what to do closer to the time of death, lots of different practices, what to do with the crown chakra, what to do there, and the breath, and all the things afterwards to help our poor people who've died already. There's masses more to go. So we enjoy ourselves tomorrow, and thank you so much. And I hope there's been some benefit to what we've been talking about. And I'm even too tired to sing a prayer, so forget prayers. Just dedicate and be happy and go home. Okay? All right. Well, you can better sing a prayer. Come on, you sing a prayer. Well, you sing a prayer. You sing a prayer. Okay, good. Go on.
I have a dedication here from one anonymous sponsor. May we hear the wisdom of the teachings and transform our minds into happiness machines, endlessly carrying all sentient beings into the bliss of liberation. May all our teachers have long and happy lives.
Well, you couldn't wish better than that, could you? Thank you, darlings, very much. Thank you, thank you, thank you.